Referring to one of the SMSs you sent, Honourable Hill Lewis, regarding the NRCS. Is it an email? Yeah, right. Now, I took it off myself. I tended to think it was an SMS. Anyway, in that particular regard, without reading that message, it referred to the CEO's contract, and there was one other item, but that was the main issue, in fact, the CEO. Pardon? Oh, yes. But, right. Now, both of those, I did, in fact, approach the department on this matter, and I was reminded that this was in the strategic plan, that the strategic plan is effectively the CEO's contract. It is captured there, one. Two, also in the annual performance plan. Now, I've already got one, and I have called for a copy to be distributed to all of you. Unfortunately, there are limitations on the printer. So I just want to address that at the moment and indicate that that is the response I have received from the department in this regard. I then would like to move to just checking on the agenda, which indicated that minutes of the 17th were here. I had challenges with those minutes, so they are being revised, and they will be available tomorrow. So on that particular note, the NRCS and the quarterly report, fourth quarter, non-financial performance and financial in the NCR, followed by adjournment and announcements. In future, it's always going to be and announcements, you know, anything that's coming in the way of an invitation like that as well. We did get your medical apology, Honourable Mkongi, and I think I know what the problem is, and I'm sorry that you're having a recurrent attack. Right, on that particular note, and we propose that someone adopts the agenda. Can we have a proposal? Thank you, Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Kernhoff. Now for the apologies, which you will deal with, Mr. Madima.
Good morning. Honourable Coronel, who attend the current technology meeting at 9:45, and Honourable J. Effenhazen will leave at 12 o'clock. Other than that, we don't have any other apologies. Thanks.
Take it, Honourable J. Effenhazen, you're going to energy. SARS. So, which committee is that? Oh, so that's a personal thing. So we need, and you know, if the meeting goes beyond 12, then, as you know, whenever you leave a committee, you need to get the support of your chief whip or senior whip in that regard, which I'm sure you have received. Thank you. Right. With respect to the department, you're very well, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Yes, thanks for your response to my email, Chair. Could I just say that if the performance contract, or rather the key performance indicators in the performance contract of the CEO are the same as those that appear in the APB and the strategic plan, and the CEO's salary and performance bonus is declared publicly in the annual report of the NRCS, then there should be no objection to just releasing the document, because there's nothing confidential in it. But the two things which you've now confirmed are both public. So I repeat my request that the NRCS or the DCI provide to the committee a copy of the CEO's performance contract, please.
Thank you for your comment and request, Honourable Hill Lewis. What I would like to do, Mr. Medina is unable to give me the legal advice. He's not here as a lawyer, but I'd like to clarify this with Parliament, our legal team, to see whether or not we can request these documents, or whether we have to take further steps in this regard to accompany that request. I myself am not sure. So I will take this further and come back on Tuesday. Thank you. And we welcome the DG of Trade and Industry yet again, Mr. Lionel October, the Group Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Jodie Scott, Mr. Damana, Chief Director, IDD, thank you very much. And in attendance for the National Regulator, we'll welcome you in due course, and I'll just welcome your CEO, Mr. Moodley. But you will be coming up in a minute. And I know we've also got the National Credit Regulator, just sitting over there, Ms. Montagari. Thank you very much. Okay, on that note then, if we can just do the consideration of the minutes of the 18th of August. On the 18th of August, the last page is the schedules. I have since then, in line with our new rules, been putting in the time that we finish and also the times that people are leaving for other reasons. I did not implement this on the 18th, but only as from, I think it was the 20th. 23rd. So there, all your names correct and in line. Fine. Apologies. And now for the attendance. Page 1. Page 2. Further apologies noted. Opening and welcome. Committee business, adoption of the agenda, science and Council of Scientific and Industrial Research. Page 3, presentation SABS, presentation Railroad Association, presentation Manufacturing Circle, announcements. What you're also looking at is transcript, which I've referred to. We now have a confirmation that the handout, the transcript of the colloquium, will be available and distributed on Tuesday next week. Announcements, adjournment 3. Fine. On that note, can we have someone please propose adoption of the minutes Thursday the 18th of August? Thank you, Honourable Montash, seconded by the Honourable Williams. Thank you. Right, and we now have on time, 9:15, 11 o'clock, we now have the NRCS on sports quarter financial and non-financial performance. You're very welcome, as I said, Mr. Moodley, Ms. Matua, Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Katz, right, General Manager, Cape Town Office, Mr. E. Matemba, Mr. E. Matemba, Strategy and Risk Management, is on his way. Oh, to remind him to get up earlier. Right. Anyway, there we are. So we'll see him when we see him. Over to you then, Mr. Asfigan Moodley.
Thanks, Chairperson, and honourable members of the committee. I'll do the performance, the presentation on the non-financial performance part, Chairperson, with your permission. And with the financial performance, I'll hand over to the CFO thereafter. So what we'll do today is a strategic overview of the analysis. We'll go through that very quickly because we've done this before. And then we'll talk about the actual performance against the targets. As I said, we'll do the non-financial performance first. And thereafter, the CFO will do the financial performance, and then we'll deal with a bit of challenges and highlights with regard to the fourth quarter. Yeah, I'll do the challenges and highlights before we go to the financial performance. So, Chairperson, just to recap our...
Could I just ask you to raise your voice?
Yes. Just to recap on the mandate of the NRCS. The NRCS derives its mandate from Act No. 5 of 2008, and our mandate is consumer and environmental protection from non-compliant and safe products and fair trade in terms of measurements which include rates and other sorts of measurements. Our strategic goals, as found in the strategic documents, is to ensure, to develop, maintain, and administer compulsory specifications. That's the first one. And I think we've gone through a bit of discussion previously how we do that. Our second strategic goal is to conduct surveillance activities to maximize compliance with all specifications and technical regulations. This is our surveillance and market surveillance activities and enforcement activities. We also have a goal to inform and educate our stakeholders about the NRCs, and then of course the fourth goal is to ensure that we have an optimally capacitated institution. Our vision is to be a credible and respected regulator for compulsory specifications and fair trade, and we do this by developing compulsory specifications and technical regulations and by putting in place measures to promote maximum compliance to regulated products. As I mentioned earlier, our legislative mandate is derived from the following Acts of Parliament: the National Regulator for Compulsory Specification Act, the Legal Methodology Act, the NBR and BS Act, and we do get mandate from other acts such as the Foodstuffs Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act. We enter into MOUs with other departments such as the Department of Transport as well, from where we get a mandate to some of the surveillance work as well. The sectors that we are currently involved with: automotive sector, vehicles, homologation of all vehicles, replacement components such as lining, brake pads, friction material, brake fluid, and so forth. And we also look after the compliance by manufacturers, importers, and builders of vehicles. In the chemicals, materials, mechanical sector, we deal with products such as cement, chemicals, household detergents, personal protective equipment, building materials, and so forth. In the electrotechnical sector, we deal with all electrical appliances and products, all those products that require electricity or energy to function, that falls under the scope of the electrotechnical sector. In the foods and associated industry sector, we deal with three products, canned meat and processed meat. Legal metrology deals with measurements. Here we look at calibration of measuring instruments, weights, measures and gaming equipment, as well as labeling and measurement requirements in terms of the product itself. In the building sector, we are tasked to ensure to promote the uniform interpretation and implementation of national building regulations and building standards and to administer the national review board. Our actual performance against the set targets for the fourth quarter. In terms of the number of new amended DCs, technical regulations that are subject to the DCI, we had a target of 3 and we went in 3, so there's no variance there. Technical papers, a target of 1 technical paper, but this was already issued during the third quarter, so we didn't have to, we didn't carry over to the fourth quarter. It was due by the end of the third quarter and we reported accordingly. In terms of administering the review board, the target is that for all decisions by the review board to be communicated within 30 days from the finalization of the case, and this was achieved. We didn't have any variance in that one. With regard to the enforcement and the market surveillance sector, in the automotive industry, we had a target of 800 inspections in total, 640 soft and 160 retail, but the sector, unit was able to perform 1,019 inspections. And this is because we are focused quite a bit on the source. Chairperson, you would recall that we had a lengthy discussion around how we have reprogrammed our work to focus more on the source of products so that we stop these non-compliant and unsafe products from entering into trade prior to them entering into trade, so that we don't have to have to deal with the impact of these products after they enter into trade. However, having said that, there are always situations where products do get into trade, even though we target our inspections and severance at source, so we do retail inspections as well. So we spent a lot more time with the source to try and prevent these products from getting into the marketplace, and in this case, in the retail sector as well, we did quite a bit of work there because we found that a lot of products were getting into the retail sector, and we need to give a bit of attention into the retail sector as well. So in the automotive environment, there was 1,019 against 800. In terms of the LOAs in the automotive sector, 96% of them were completed within 120 days. That's 1,155 or 1,204. In the chemicals, manufacturing, materials and mechanical sector, inspections, as a target of 1,148, we were able to do 1,221. And in terms of the LOAs, 53% of them were dealt, and it was simply because of the we received a number of LOAs for treated timber and safety footway. However, the species have not come into operation by then. They have now come into the operation, and we are attending to all these LOAs. So there was no disadvantage for any of the applicants in terms of these LOA applications, simply because the VCs have not come into operation. Now that the VCs have come into operation, we are giving attention to these LOAs that were not dealt with previously. In terms of the electrotechnical industry, our target was 1,056 inspections for the fourth quarter. We achieved 1,147 inspections. In terms of the LOAs, 71% of the LOAs were processed within the year. Within time, limited time period of 180 days. In the legal metrology sector, here again, our total of inspection for the fourth quarter was 1,212. The unit achieved 1,345 inspections. And here again, we have dedicated the number of resources to non-compliant industries. And although the inspections were targeted, where it was found that we had to do some in-law inspections, we conducted those as well. Application for type approvals, all of them were achieved within the time period. However, in the gaming sector, we had an abnormal situation. We had 200% increase in the number of applications received in November and December as a result of the deadlines set by the gambling board. So it was a very abnormal situation, and we gave attention to it. During the fourth quarter, we achieved 44%, but as we stand as of today, there's only 10 applications that are out of the time period, and it is being attended to urgently.
Explain a little bit more about those gaming, whether they're gaming machines or what?
Yes, we celebrate the gaming machines, we look at the gaming machines, and we give the approval for the gaming machines to be put into use.
They're imported?
Most of the gaming machines are imported, yes. In terms of the food that we associated with the sector, associated in this sector. In terms of all locally declared produce,
you said that this was a decoder or something. That was asked a code question. I think there might be a mistake in these slides. On all of your sections where you report on LOAs, you're saying 120 working days.
Yes.
Is that an error? We've been told in the past that you've told them in the past that you've moved to 120 calendar days on all of these LOA applications.
Yes, it's 120 days. It's calendar days. That's definitely an error.
All right. So well, I'm glad we got the clarity. Thanks to you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Thank you.
Yeah, good calendar days. Okay, ma'am, then we move to the food and associated industries. In terms of locally produced catfish and meat products, all that was declared was attended to within the prescribed period. In terms of inspections on locally produced frozen products, our target was 261, but we performed 272 inspections in the quarter. For all declared imported catfish, meat and frozen fishery products, all of those that were declared to the NRCS were attended to within the period, the prescribed period. In terms of requests for export inspections, you would recall, Madam Chair, that whenever we send fish and fishery products out of the country, the food and associated industries is together with the competent authority, and we have to issue a health guarantee before the products go abroad. So 100% of those were dealt with when the period is required. And in terms of facility inspections, these are your facilities that produce fish and fishery products. Our target was 255 inspections, and we achieved 258 within the period. In terms of increased awareness of the NRCS brand and functions, we were supposed to conduct an awareness campaign. We didn't do that because we couldn't appoint the service provider timely. However, there were other awareness programs that were in the that we had we were undertaking, and we allocated the budget to the other programs so that we actually achieve awareness of the NRCS grant functions. Of course, we are planning that in the new financial year we'll be able to give some attention to this area. In terms of programs, publications, our target was to have the internal, one external publication produced during the quarter, three internal and one while we are produced. In terms of multimedia awareness campaign, we targeted one as multimedia awareness campaign, and this was done. stakeholder consumer events, we had one, we had targeted two, but we had one, and we had redirected some effort into the destruction event that was held in Cape Town. We utilized the destruction event in Cape Town to also conduct some consumer education awareness as well. In terms of the fourth priority that we have, the vacancy rate, our target is 6%, but we had a vacancy rate of 6.8%. This was due to a number of retirements we had last year in the last financial year. In terms of training for the officials of the NRCS, we have targeted 30 for the fourth quarter, but we were able to train 71, and this is because we used the training a bit more efficiently, where we were able to get group training. We arranged for group training so that we use one training session to train more than the target number of people. In terms of the IT platform, system availability, the target is 96%. The system was available for 98% of the time. So, Madam Chair, just on the overall, we didn't put the overall statistics here, but the overall statistics for the RCS as a whole. In terms of the infections, our target for the fourth quarter was 12,229. We had achieved 12,759, and these are some of the figures that are in the individual units in presentation. In terms of airway applications, 4,043 was should have been done in the fourth quarter. We managed to achieve 3,130 as overall, which translates to a 78% achievement for the fourth quarter. Madam Chair, I would leave it there, and I would then ask the CFO to deal with the financial performance, and then we'll come back to the challenges and highlights.
Right, thank you. That is Ms. Matura, is it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So in terms of the financial performance, basically what we're demonstrating here is where we sit at the end of the fourth quarter. We're giving you a cumulative reflection of what each quarter looks like. So in terms of our revenue for the fourth quarter, we collected a total amount of 309 million. Expenditures at 307 million, leaving us with preliminary surplus at the end of quarter four at 2.6 million. Of importance is that if you look at the approved budget column, basically what we've done there is we've indicated a potential deficit due to the fact that our government funding was reduced significantly in that year. We would have had to release cash from our reserves to simply supplement our operations. But what you can see in the actual figures is we actually didn't have to.
While you're on there, before you go to the next chart or page, slide, just look at the line, transfers for the DPI. Now, I'm just trying to get a handle on this. You have the first quarter, the second quarter, the third and fourth, and then you have the year to date. So, that total, then it's not total per se, because the way I would have seen it is you would add up those figures and get a total.
That's good. These are cumulative figures for each of the quarters, so they're not the quarters represented.
That's what about the year-to-date, the last column?
Yes, it marries up to the final quarter. So we could have eliminated the year-to-date actual.
Yeah, because, you know, to me, the actual year-to-date would be that total.
Yes.
So, in fact, you're saying that's a duplication, that column, of
yes.
the fourth.
Yes.
Thank you. But then just cut off duplication.
When you're looking at the revenue, essentially this gives you an indication of the spread of the revenue income into the organization. Bulk of our revenue comes from our levies. We're sitting with around 49% of total income that comes in from levies. We've got around 30% of revenue that comes in from the government funding and the DPI, with the remaining coming from interest income combined with the services that we render as well. Our expenditure around 1% basically reflects recovery on costs and things like that. When we look at the financial overview in respect of the revenue per quarter, this once again is a cumulative indication of the revenue that we've collected over the year. So we're sitting with the highest growth in revenue in the final quarter from our compulsory specifications, our levy. So you're looking at the third column from your left-hand side. The DTI funding was essentially received in whole in the second quarter. In terms of financial performance on expenditure, the bulk of our expenditure goes to employee costs. You're sitting with a total of 36% of total expenditure on employee costs, with the balance spent on goods and services. The other costs that you will see are non-financial, so that's really your depreciation and your provisions and things like that. In respect of our expenditure, what we're doing here is we're demonstrating to you where the bulk of our expenditure goes. So the bulk of our money goes into Goal 2. Goal 2 is really our surveillance function that we perform. You're sitting with a total of 197 odd million going into surveillance. The next highest allocation is Goal 4. Goal 4 is focusing on improving efficiencies within the organization. And sitting in this goal, you have your ICT, your HR, your finance sort of functions. And the other large allocation is your admin function, which is really your support function to the NRCS. So really what this slide does is it demonstrates once again your expenditure per category, also giving you an indication of how it has grown over each of the quarters. So you're looking at the first one being employee cost. Although employee cost is the highest of our expenditure, you will notice that it is under the budget that we had originally planned to expend on employee cost. Goods and services also reflected a significant savings as well, which contributed to a great extent to the ultimate surplus that we had, not having to draw from the cash reserve. We would also like to brief the committee on the progress with regard to dealing with our audit qualification. So perhaps just to put things back into context, NRCS sits yet again with a revenue qualification this year. The main issue is the fact that NRCS collects revenue, which is non-exchange revenue, classified in terms of GRAC 23 accounting standards, which requires this revenue to be recognized based on the taxable event. In the NRCS's case, the taxable event is the manufacture or import of regulated goods. GRAC 23 further acknowledges the difference between the taxable event and the recording of revenue from that taxable event. Further to that, in our discussions with the Auditor General, they have indicated that the NRCS Act regulations basically indicate that we should be recording revenue at the taxable event and not at a later date. Obviously, this starts to question the clarity in terms of the Act and whether or not the Auditor General interpretation of the NRCS Act is the correct one, or is the NRCS one the correct one. Further to that, the Auditor General has indicated that the Act is weak on punitive measures when it comes to financial aspects. It is pretty strong on punitive measures when it comes to compliance aspects, however, with regard to product. The Auditor General has also further indicated that contributing to the qualification is the fact that systems and controls are not in place to recognize that revenue at the point of import or at the point of manufacture. And that then also ties into the fact that the information that we have isn't fully integrated within the organization. So in order to deal with the qualification, NRCS has put in place a lot of plans and has actually succeeded in implementing a couple of them. But basically what we're trying to do here is to draw attention to the key high-level plans that have the greatest impact in terms of attempting to deal with the qualification. We've clarified them into two broad areas, the first of which is the legislative options. So in light of the fact that Auditor General has a concern around the vagueness of the Act or their interpretation is slightly different from ours, one of the things we agreed we'll do is obtain a legal opinion regarding the intention of the specific clauses within the Act. And then once that has been done, we will then engage with the Auditor General and establish whether or not our act indeed needed to be changed. Because the last thing we wanted was to change an act only to find that the act was not the main contributor. In addition to that, what we've attempted to do is look internally at those mechanisms that we do control as an organization to see what other things we could look at to reasonably establish what our revenue should be at a particular point in time. And the one thing we have established is our control over LOAs. A lot of our LOAs don't have validity periods. Our LOAs also don't give an indication of the volumes that will be imported over a period of time, leaving us at the mercy of the market. And at a point in time, we're not sure what an importer or a manufacturer has produced so that we can recognize that revenue, because our revenue is based on the volume. So we're essentially looking at introducing LOA validity periods for those LOAs that don't have them, and potentially also looking at quarterly volume forecasts, which will assist us in estimating our revenue. So that is the next thing the Auditor General is saying, is we don't have sufficient information to estimate our revenue. And due to the fact that markets change, the business cycles of different industries vary, we don't have all that data to make those estimations. Tying into that, we're looking at improving our internal controls. I think that's a given. Our big project at this point in time is looking at modernizing ERCS, together with implementing ERP system and streamlining our business processes to be more efficient. And linked into this is our collaboration with SARS at the point of import. So our progress on this plan, in terms of legal opinion, we have obtained the legal opinion. We have had discussions with the Auditor General. We're not necessarily in agreement at this stage. We have also indicated to the DTI that we would like to engage with them on a way forward in terms of how we should deal with this different opinion, and then also a planned meeting with the Auditor General as well. In terms of the LOA conditionality, we're still at a very early stage, because there is a new idea that has come to the table, where we need to explore the implications of this. And then on the modernization project, we have already put in place a committee that has developed a concept in terms of where we see ourselves in RCS in 10 years' time. And what are those things that we should be focusing on? We're going to leverage off the strength of our ICT steering committee to assist us to prioritize the key foundations of this modernization project prior to deciding how we need to reorganize our business. And then finally, our SARS collaboration is in progress as we speak. We are in the process of finalizing the code with SARS. So what HSS code project attempts to do is that it attempts to align the NRCS commodity codes with the SARS tariff codes. In so doing, when a regulated product, a regulated commodity comes into the country, we will know of it. We are also sharing information with SARS in terms of the LOA database so they can stop products that don't have the LOAs attached to them. So this collaboration is essential for us when it comes to import.
I'm worried about the abbreviations that are used throughout the documents. My assumption is that we, as much as we, they are talking to us as a committee, the public out there needs to know what they're talking about. So they saw the document, they're saying LOA, HSFS, and whatever, it's a problem for me.
We sometimes overlook the fact, Mr. Moodley, that not all of our members are full-time members here, and they are out at other committees, in this case the Labour Committee, and may have missed an earlier meeting where, you know, this was given to us. So if you could do that, but just to assist us immediately, I think you've all been given this, have you? Am I right? Yes. Well, some of us are old-standing members on the committee, so we just know where to find these things, don't we? On a serious note, the NRCS updated strategic plan, which I think you've got there, but on the other hand, it will help if you're able to do that, and also on the in the specific presentation, you do have that
as well. So let's keep, what page is that? Page 30. Right. So in the current acronyms we've got here. Okay. But I must say, it does mind boggle when I saw VC, I thought it was the Victorian Cross, and you're telling me it's compulsory specs. Where does the V come from? I don't know, was this a French term then? You know, I must say, is it French?
No, no, ma'am, it's Afrikaans, I think. It comes from the very long time ago when we were still with Tabs.
Yes, for?
Somebody can tell.
I mean, you know, surely we should know. I know. All right, let us not, delay ourselves on that. I'm sure you'll let us know, Mr. Moody, because I think it's intriguing. Right. Yeah, can we?
Yeah, no,
are we all
on back then? Thanks very much. Just to confirm that we do have a list of abbreviations and acronyms on the last slide, but we will look at it to see whether we've dealt with it properly, and it is quite possible that we may have missed one or two, and then we'll certainly include that in. So, ma'am, just to go to the key highlights and challenges, we have updated 8 compulsory specifications that were submitted to the DCI. In terms of our corporate social responsibility, we have had a number of paradigm stove awareness events, which we've been using to highlight the dangers of non-compliant products themselves. And I just wanted to pause at the point a little bit to say that these paradigm stove events have given us a lot of information on the level of non-compliant products that are still coming into the country. Madam Chair, just to say that yesterday we've gone to a sort of more effective, what is looked at as a more effective and efficient way of doing work. So we don't just simply go and look at some place to see if there's non-compliant products. We generally do a risk assessment. We do a targeted approach where we analyze the industries, and then we go to the industries where there is the highest risk of these products being non-compliant and unsafe. Just yesterday we looked at in the Western Cape region, and we had to confiscate more than 1.6 million rands worth of non-compliant products that was found in trade, and these products would have had the potential to create serious harm to the consumer and to the environment. And then 2 or 3 weeks ago, the associated industries, we had to then turn back 450 tons of prawns, because these prawns were found to be unsafe for human consumption. They came from somewhere in the east, and they were just underwater to come to South Africa. And when we did tests of some of the samples, we found that they were really, really, very, very bad. We couldn't allow them into the country in any event. And prawns are for eating. And we had to do a couple of more tests, a few more tests to confirm this, and then we had to engage with the importers and the country in question, and basically tell them that 450,000 kilograms of prawns that are unfit for human consumption cannot come to our shores, and we had to send them away. So it's serious, serious difficulties that we're having right now in terms of, although despite the extended focus of our work, despite the risk-based approach and giving attention to the source, there's still a huge number of non-compliant drugs that are attempting to enter the countries. In all aspects, the electric yesterday's project resulted in 1.6 million rand worth of electronic and electrical equipment being taken away from the marketplace. Just for the annual report achievements, more than 100 million, well, approximately 100 million rand worth of non-compliant products were confiscated in the last year. And then, of course, during the year, we developed Vision 2020 to support the strategic plan of the NRCS. The Vision 2020 document is a 5-year document talking to what we expect to achieve in the year 2020, which is really to try and have no non-compliant products in the marketplace, and to ensure that all products that are supposed to be regulated are in fact regulated. With implementing this risk-based approach for enforcement, and as you know that we are also busy with the implementation of the risk-based approach for LOAs, Madam Chair, you would recall that we have a session on the 14th of September where we will come back and give full and detailed, very comprehensive information on the risk-based approach for LOAs, the policy, the implementation, and the status quo as we are today, while we look as of the 14th of September. We are collaborating quite one came to me with the staff. Reshma spoke about the project on the HS floats, which we have acquired to the service provider to assist us with. But on water enforcement, on keeping out non-compliant products, SARS is a key partner for us, and they also bring to our attention quite a few consignments of non-compliant products that come to the country, which we're able to give attention to. Operational challenges, the application of regulation of products are under compulsory specifications. Sometimes these are outdated, and we have to then go and look at all of these. Madam Chair, when non-compliant and unsafe products come to the country, very often these products are abandoned once we try to get more information on them. There is a huge problem in that the importer says, look, I've got this information on the import document. I don't know they were non-compliant. And then when we go to the, for example, I gave this example previously, LEDs, CFRs, compact fluorescent lights. We have 44 containers of them, and it could be a few hundred thousand in each container. When we go to the address, even on the documentation, we find that it is non-existent. So then it becomes our responsibility, because as I mentioned previously, each of these lights contains a small amount of mercury, but the cumulative total of all that mercury could be quite, it could have some serious effects on the environment. So we have to then destroy these lights in an environmentally friendly manner, environmentally required manner. Now it costs us for transportation, it costs us to keep those products, and further it costs us to destroy these products. Yet we have to ensure that these products don't come into the country. So we've adopted the approach that at the port of entry, we try as far as possible that we work with SARS. And if there is no LOA for a product, it shouldn't be allowed into the country. Of course, where there is an LOA, then SARS will take the necessary action to allow these products through to the There's long turnaround times test houses as well. You find that we get an application from an LOA. We then want to do the testing to ensure that the product complies. We have to use the test houses in order to promote our independence. So the rigorousness with which, because of the high volumes of non-compliant products that are finding their way into the country, and I just gave you an example in one day, 1.6 million rand, we have to be very careful about products that we're applying. So we ask for samples, we send them to test houses. Test houses do take a bit of time because they want to confirm themselves that indeed the products comply, because if they give us a test report that says it complies and it doesn't comply, then there are negative impacts, there's consequences for the test houses as well. So this also adds to the challenges that we have faced. In terms of the border enforcement, this is the part of entry of the stopping the products, non-compliant unsafe products at the source. I must say that even up to now, despite all the effort that we've put in, there's been a noticeable improvement. However, there's still a significant proportion of the imports where the information supplied on both the bill of entry and the shipping manifest is incorrect. In fact, sometimes you can probably say that it is misleading. It is actually completed in such a way as to mislead the reader of those shipping manifest bill of entry. And then it takes a whole lot of effort for us to look at those, try to ascertain what's the correct information. A very small example, protective clothing is a regulated item. But when the manifest comes, it just simply says clothing. It doesn't say protective clothing. Now, clothing, of course, you know, is not regulated products, shirts and ties and so forth. So we have to make a determination now from lots of information that we have today. Indeed, this will be protective clothing or normal clothing. And we have to give it attention because non-compliant protective clothing, the gas marks and so forth that come into the country can have disastrous consequences. Can you imagine if a miner gets a gas mark that doesn't work and he goes underneath to do some mining and it doesn't work very well, it could be disastrous, the consequences could be disastrous. So our work has to be really, really rigorous in as far as all of that is concerned. And I mentioned about the high number of abandoned goods at the ports of entry. These really results in very, very high costs, not in terms of monetary costs only, but the cost of the impact to the environment. Madam Chair, last time I was here at Parliament, I mentioned about the computer equipment as well, and where there are certain countries in the world who like to donate pre-used second-hand computers to schools in South Africa. The challenge is that these computers only have a very short life period, and once they are finished, we have to dispose of those computers in the South African environment. Now, in the rest of the world, there are very, very strict rules and regulations about how these products are disposed of. And then we also have very careful rules about how these products are disposed of. So what happens is that although it sounds as if there is an effort to assist the schools in and so forth, but the consequences of what happens to that product after a short life period in terms of the environment and so forth is quite high. So these are some of the challenges that we experience. Revenue challenge, I think the CFO has spoken about that, and I would not go too much onto that. So, Madam Chair, that was the information that we would have acted as NRCS to share on the fourth quarter performance. And as I mentioned, we have a date of the 14th of September to come back to deal comprehensively with the aerospace approach to the LOAs, the policy and the implementation and the where we are as far as that is concerned. And of course, we are preparing for that as well. Thank you very much.
Well, just as a point of information, the V stands for verplichtend. Verplichtend. Meer. Compulsory. Right? So why don't we just call it CC now? What is it now? VC? But there we are. But I thought it could have been French. So much of this is in French. So is that not correct then, Mr. Moody? It is, yes.
Now, I just wanted to confirm, the gaming equipment is all imported. I'll ask the question whether there's machines, and yes, just to confirm that they are imported indeed.
I will address that when we come to it, because I was under the impression we were also able to reduce certain gaming machines, but let me not deal with it this very minute, because I'd like to ask the CFO to explain this matrix, this tabulated financial performance overview on page 17. Because I have been trying to make head and tail of this. Because what I see here on the left is cumulative income and expenditure overview. Then I see audited income and approved budget for that year. Now, the approved budget for that year, I was under the impression, was the annual budget. 2016. Now, if that is the annual budget, and it was 100 million, then in the four quarters, you would have spent a portion of that each quarter. What? Secondly, I do understand that possibly the transfers from DTI, given that that was approved at 91, then you weren't too sure when it arrived in, or the figure approved budget is incorrect. What does the approved budget stand for? Because that reads for the year 2016. And if it means for the year 2016, it is a total. It is our budget for that year. And that doesn't make sense to have that figure repeated all along the quarters. So please clarify that for us. The whole table. Clarify how you tabulate your figures.
All right, thank you. So, as indicated, these are cumulative figures. So, essentially, to explain the actual quarter tabulation, the first quarter is expenditure and income up until the end of the first quarter. The second quarter will be expenditure inclusive of the first quarter and second quarter until the end of the second quarter. So if you are looking at transfers from DTI, for example, all of the money had been received by the second quarter, therefore no additional funding. You don't see that figure growing any further because it is a cumulative figure. Whereas if you go to maybe levies from compulsory specifications, you will see the accumulation. So the DTI funding, we generally prefer to receive it by the first 6 months due to the fact that our levies are very cyclical. Does that help?
It does help. Thank you. But next time, say that to start with, otherwise, and also tell us not to worry about the final column and things like that, all right? So I think that's it then, and I've dealt with just the clarifications, the obvious ones, and now I'm going to turn to the committee. I know that you said, CEO, that you are expected back, what is this date again, 16th? On the 14th of September. All right. So, members, by show of hands, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Elders, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Montash, Honourable Williams, in that order.
to the Director General or to the CEO, whoever wants to answer it. I just want to ask you very directly and on the record, do you regard, is it a deliberate strategy of the DTI to use the LOA process as a non-tariff barrier in South Africa? And if it is the case, you should be upfront and honest about that. And if it isn't the case, then we continue to raise a very serious concern about the sometimes very dire delays in the processing of applications. It's not quite accurately reflected in the presentation we received today, because it's all well and good to say that it's 53% of applications are dealt with within 120 days, and for some it's 72%, or whatever the case may be. But what that doesn't tell you is just how long those which are not processed within 120 days are actually outstanding. And I can tell you, and I have provided many examples to you, and I'm happy to provide more, of some of them being 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, sometimes even more than that, outstanding. And that is causing real, real bottlenecks and delay in the economy. And the reason I ask the first question is because you and I can have a debate about whether that's legitimate if you're trying to protect a local manufacturer and you're using it as a non-tariff barrier. But there's lots of examples where we are dragging our heels on issuing LOAs on legitimate, high-quality, single manufacturer imports where there is only one producer of that product in the world. They don't produce in South Africa, nor will they ever. They're made in Japan. I'm happy to provide more examples of this if you need it. And so I don't understand why we are throwing the baby out of the bathwater if you are using it as a non-tariff barrier. And so I just want to ask you that upfront and directly and on the record, and I would appreciate your honest response. I'd like a breakdown of, in addition to the feedback on how many of your LOAs are dealt with within the 120 calendar days, I would like a breakdown on those that are not dealt with within 120 days, how long they've been outstanding. And I think that should become a standard reporting feature to say so many are 140 days, so many are 200 days, whatever the case is. And then on the awareness program, which is very important and which I support, it strikes me as odd that a service provider was not appointed timely. What exactly does it mean? Does that mean that you started appointing a service provider and then cancelled it? Or did you never actually start appointing a service provider? And then my final question, if I can squeeze it in this 3 minutes, is to the DG or the COO, Ms. Coles. There's a number of, we've been through this overview of the performance. There's a number of areas in which there has been a fairly significant underperformance. My question, as a matter of policy to the DGI, what is the consequence for underperformance on AVPs and KPIs? From your side as DGI management, what is the consequence? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right. Honourable Elder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. My three questions. First of all, I would like to know what happens to goods imported into South Africa without LOAs, but those goods are quite new or unique products that do not have CE standards as yet in terms of the current legislation. How do you deal with that when you discover those goods? Secondly, does the NRCS monitor government use of equipment imports? I think one of the easier ways to monitor goods coming in is to look at what government is importing and to ensure that government is actually using goods that have been certified in terms of the legal process. So are you doing that, and are you also looking not only at government in a strict sense but also its agencies? Thirdly, in terms of inspection and confiscation, what are the criteria upon which you decide to disallow goods to be used or imported into South Africa? You've mentioned the food products, and I suppose there are other dangerous goods, but there are also goods that might be innocuous itself, but the use of it can present quite a lot of dangers, like measuring and weighing instruments. that must be used for certain products in South Africa. When do you decide that you will not allow the use thereof, or you will actually allow the use despite the fact that it has not been compliant with the legislation? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert, Honourable Williams. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I've been here 2.5 years, and the NRC is like a bad movie on repeat, and you can't change it. And it's the same horror show. And the only thing that has changed, and there's only one thing that's changed, Mr. Moody, and that has been going from calendar days, or from working days to calendar days, and that's because of the pressure of the committee. That's the only thing that's changed, but nothing else has changed. You assured the committee that the refaced approach would be up by June. It's not happened. I do not believe for a second that the 29% of the variance of electrotechnical LOAs was because of insufficient documentation. It's improbable that many applications would be a result of insufficient documentation. I hesitate to suggest actually that one of the real reasons is because of the woeful communication and feedback that exists in the NRCS. Now, I've got people that wait 3 months just to get a response from the NRCS, and even then it's flimsy at best. And so we keep having the same discussion about the same issue and nothing changes. And what's concerning for me is that it's quite obvious that the NRCS does not have the human resources or the financial resources to deal with the amount of applications. But the obvious solution on the table seems to be the thing that meets the most resistance. And so I just, for the life of me, can't understand why. And in fact, I've seen, and I know that's a concern for the DTI, because I've seen internal communication in the DTI that says, and I quote, "It is clearly a major issue for this for industry."
One moment, I'm not sure I heard you correctly, but did you actually say that you have seen internal communication? I would assume that internal communication would have been open to the public, as you referred to it here.
Well, it was communication that I received from DTI, from a source of
data. So you received a letter, yes. Right.
Well, not a letter, but I received a communication in the DTI. So the DTI knows that it's a problem, but there seems to be no pressure on the NRCS to get it right. And so, as the Honourable Hill-Lewis correctly said, you know, you have very specific items, high quality, high specification items that only come from single manufacturers in Japan or Germany, industrial equipment used for, you know, very specific purposes. And it's subjected to this long, arduous process. Yet, and still, you can go into the China malls. I'd love to know how many, you know, inspections are conducted there. And you can go and buy whatever you want, and you all know, and everyone knows that it's non-compliant. So it means that it's easier to go after the easy target than to actually go where the problem is. I mean, a grand piano is no threat to anyone, as far as I'm concerned. But yet it's subjected to the same standard of testing and requirements in the 120 calendar days as other products. It doesn't make sense. So when is the risk-based management program going to be up and running, and why, and what are the reasons for the delays?
Honourable Mantosh.
I've got only two questions. The first would be, why is that all the gaming machines imported? And how is that assisting us in the drive for local procurement of goods? Because we think that would increase our job creation campaign. On the education of headquarters, why is it only using multimedia? It's the only way you can use is educating your consumers so that they can understand what you are doing as an entity.
Thank you, Honourable Mantosh. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. First, I just want to welcome the presentation. I have a few questions. Firstly, I just want to get some clarity, and then I'll come back to this. You said that clothes are not regulated, so there's no requirement for clothes, and I was just wondering about baby's clothes that are imported. Perhaps some of them could be highly flammable or have buttons and things that can cut the child. I was just wondering about those products. I'm a bit concerned about that. And then I just want to move on to the fact that over the last year, nearly 100 million rands was non-compliant product. Now, this is quite a large amount of products that were non-compliant, and as your mandate is consumer and environment protection, I know you can't estimate what that 100 million rand would be relative to everything that was imported, but you must have some idea of how much do you think gets through, because obviously, if you had more resources, you'd do more inspections. So I just want to sort of estimate, is that 100 million rand, you think that's 2% of the non-compliant stuff getting through, or what do you estimate that could be? I'm also looking forward to the meeting on the 14th of September where we can get some real clarity and down to the nitty-gritty when it comes to LOAs. So I'm looking forward to that meeting. But lastly, I think it's unreasonable for Honourable MacPherson to say things like a bad movie and a horror show, as this entity is actually protecting our community and our environment. And it's not here to protect importers that fundamentally don't really create jobs in our country. We need to seriously start putting our people first and not always put the importer first in the particular case. Because although the importer obviously does create some jobs, but they must comply and they must be inspected the same as everybody else. On the 14th, we'll hear what the plan is to give the importer that has proven themselves not to be dodgy less time, perhaps. But I think until then, we shouldn't just assume that a variance of 29% is improbable, because it's about as improbable as the relationship between the importers and the Democratic Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. I do have a few more here that I'd like to raise. The one is on page 12, or slide 12, a reference made to the number of source inspections conducted in the legal metrology domain. Just great clarification on that area. And then you alluded to issues such as amended specifications at one stage. Please, Mr. Moody, if you could tell us, I think it was slide 8, the number of new and amended and withdrawn VCs. Give me an example of a VC where you've withdrawn it and why.
Thank you very much, Alison. I will answer some of the questions, and I think the DG may want to delegate others. Okay, so the first question is, there's a bit of strategy of the either both people of the DTI, but of the NRCS. No, there's no strategy from the NRCS to be a non-tariff barrier or anything of that sort. Our mandate is very, very simple. We protect the consumer and the environment. Yes. Our mandate is very simple, Madam Chair. We protect the consumer and the environment from non-compliant, unsafe products, and we promote fair trade. That is what we do. We are not in the business of promoting economic development or hindering economic development. That is for the DTI and the other agencies. We've clarified this several times, and I want to repeat, we are not a non-tariff or a tariff barrier to trade or anything else. At the end of the day, our job is consumer protection, and we will do it without fear or favor. We will put whatever measures are in place in order to ensure that the consumer and the environment is protected from harmful and dangerous products, and to ensure that the consumer experiences fair trade. We are certainly not engaged with the DTI or any other agency to become a barrier to trade or anything like that. So if there is a barrier to trade that is being impeded, it's because
since 2008 to now, we found that the culture of compliance in this country was 30%. If we can get the LOAs to move from 400% to 1,200, sorry, 400 per month to 1,200 per month in a one year period, it showed that 60 to 70% of the people do not comply. So there's a huge culture of non-compliance. We are receiving non-compliant, dangerous goods daily in the country. So that is what we are. That is what our job is, and that is what we are working against. So I would deal with. In terms of LOAs on high quality products, yes, indeed we have made an undertaking to the city parliament. The report will show. I will not say anything else in that regard. On the 14th of September, we will come and give you, Madam Chair, very extensive information on how we have applied. I think even the Honourable Hill Lewis and Honourable McPherson has experienced that some of the own people who had married with them will be able to deal with this, although on a limited basis, not to the extent they probably wanted, but on a limited basis, we were able to deal with this using a sort of a space approach. We will come and give a lot of extensive information, and we would also confirm that those importers who are generally compliant and who bring high quality products, there is a barrier. But unfortunately, up to now, and I've clarified this a couple of times, is that there is a queue, and your application gets into the queue, and it has to wait till it's attended to. And that is why we came up with the risk-based approach, just like the prepared supplier system in the South, where we can give attention to those industries who are generally compliant. But we provide full information on that on the 14th. With regard to the breakdown, yes, we will provide that. Madam Chair, with your permission, I would ask the NRCS to provide a breakdown. The service provider, yes, in fact, I think members would know that the supply chain management processes in government is a bit onerous, and if we don't follow that, we would be recognized as irregular expenditure. Madam Chair, you would recall that in 2008, 2009, or around 2011, irregular expenditure in the NRCS was 33 million. We put in a huge number of control measures and processes to attempt that irregular expenditure. You find that in the latest audit report, it's under 500,000. So, but unfortunately, when you put in these control measures into place, it does lengthen the time that it takes to get these services. Unless it is indeed that we want to do that in this current financial year. It wasn't funny timely in the last financial year. Okay, the part of the underperformance I will leave to the DG. Goods imported into South Africa without LOAs and that do not have standards, vulnerable habits. The challenge is that we can only, LOAs can only work according to a approved standard, approved technical regulation or compulsory certification. Where there is a void of regulation, the products that come in can't be subjected to an LOA treatment or can't be subjected to surveillance treatment. For example, the water, if there's no technical regulation for water, the water can be brought in and sold. Nothing prohibits that. However, what happens is that the NRCS Act, as well as other legislation, makes it possible, has the provision that any person who wishes to bring to the attention of the NRCS potentially safety-critical products, this is the word that they use, that could potentially harm the environment of the consumer or impact on fair trade, can make an application to the CEO to bring about regulation for those products. We have received a few of those applications. We are attending to them. The RCS can also, on its own, while it's doing its work in terms of its surveillance and so forth, can identify those products and bring about regulation. I can give you one example. Generators were previously not regulated, and we found that this is indeed a safety critical product. We are now in the process of developing the regulation for generators as well. Do we monitor government products and in terms of products coming to the country? The NRCS monitors all products coming to the country, regardless of who the... we don't actually look at the importer. We look at the product itself. So we look at an application for an LOA, and we look at consignments. When we look at consignments, we get the information from as the bill for lading, the ship's manifestation, ship's manifest, and so forth. So we don't exactly give effect to a person when we're looking at doing our surveillance. We look at the product. So products intended for government or any other institution would come under that surveillance system. What are the criteria used to disallow goods coming into South Africa? As I mentioned, it's the VC and the technical regulations. In terms of the NRCS Act, we can only work according to that. Where a set of compulsory specifications on technical regulations do not exist, then we have to set an interim set of regulations and technical regulations and compulsory specifications until we go to the full process, and then we work against that. But that is the criteria that we use for the allowing and disallowance of goods product coming to the country. On the comment that nothing has happened in the NRCS, of course I'd like to disagree, Manager. If you look at our annual report from 2009 to 2014 or 2015, you'd find there's a considerable, in fact it's a light years performance increase in the NRCS. It didn't multiply 100%, it probably multiplied 500%. If we took out 1 billion rand worth of non-compliant products over a 5-year period, and of that 548 million rand was in just 1 year, it showed the value of products right away. If we were able to move from doing surveillance at the retail environment and go to stop the products at source, it shows an improvement in the way the NRCS does work. If all the figures I've given you in terms of the our cooperation with partners and so on, there's been a huge movement in the way the NRCS is doing its work. I want to also believe, Madam Chair, that all the queries that we are getting, all the frustration that people are passing to us is because we have been effective in the way we do our work. Regulations are not really required. Most people would rather not have regulators. They would rather be left to do their things on their own. But regulators are necessary, as you know, in any economy, because we have to protect some of in this case, the people and the environment. So it becomes probable that we do cause frustration for people. But that's because we're doing our work, because we are effective. If we had not done our work, we wouldn't have had those complaints, because products will come freely into the country. It will be taken freely. So I want to suggest that indeed there's been a significant improvement in the work. Does NRCS have the human financial resources? I want to also say that there can never be enough human financial resources in any environment that I have been in. Yes, I've presented to this committee that when we do our targeted inspections, we're looking at 0.59% of the printers. Give us more people, we'll look at more. But it would cost the economy itself, because our funding comes from levies as well as offering. It's going to cost the economy. This, and there's always been the complaint from the people that we regulate about regulation costs. You would recall, Madam Chair, that I was there last year to say that we went on a drive to get an increase in our levies, and we had to keep it at the bare minimum because of the impact of regulation costs. So yes, indeed, if we have more capacity, we have more people, we could do more. I don't think there's any institution that would not welcome more people and more finances. We, of course, because of the fact that we have to do so much work, the CFO was quite correct. We had to put it into place some significant measures to keep our costs to the bare minimum, so that we actually move from a position of pulling out money from our surpluses, where we had from our cash reserves, where we had a surplus. So yes, I would. How many inspections we conducted at the China Mall, ma'am? I will provide that information. I don't have it with me, but together with the breakdown, I will then provide you with information on how many inspections we conducted various different malls. Not only the China Mall, because I'm given to understand there are also India malls and Taiwanese malls and other types of malls. So we will provide that. I would be very reluctant to single out the China Malls, but I will provide that information. Why are gaming machines imported? I believe that I'm not in a position to answer that one. And why only multimedia for education? No, ma'am, we don't only use multimedia. We deal with multimedia, but we also have outreach programs. For the people at the grassroots levels, we use the paraffin stoves awareness, paraffin stove safety awareness campaign as the platform where we actually introduce the NRCS and make the communities fully aware of non-compliant products, the impact of non-compliant products, unsafe products. I mean, we've already seen fire signs burning down. We've seen people in Cayman settlements burning down. Place of the ground, so we do go out these programs, but we do supplement it by multimedia. We have also go to shopping malls, to bus ranks, to taxi ranks, and so forth. But those are, you find them in the other portions of the annual report, not in the fourth quarter report. Williams, in terms of the baby clothes, we'll take that as an input because it was highlighted previously, but we will give it to the CMM people to a feasibility assessment to look at whether baby clothes should be regulated in terms of the flammable material and buttons and so forth. I do believe that buttons may be a problem because if the baby swallows a button, it can be catastrophic, so I think we will look at that as well. We'll take it as an input. In terms of estimates, as I mentioned, the 100 billion rand non-compliant products that we have taken away from the market, which represents us looking at 0.59% of the containers. Now, what we've done to increase the regulatory reach is we're partnering with us, we partner with SAPS, we partner with the BCOCC, the control. We've now, the KZN Education Economic Development Department has formed a new sort of a component called the consumer protection, and they are also putting in place measures to go and do inspections and surveillance and so forth where there's non-compliant unsafe products on the market. So we're all partnering with them. So we try to partner with all the various different stakeholders and roadways so that we increase the reach of the compulsory specification. So we do that. And how can we do more? What the CFO mentioned is very critical. The utilization of the HS codes by SARS would help us considerably, because at some point we envisage that we could test ourselves that these are all the products that have LOAs for the, and these are the people that have the LOAs. So if a product consignment comes into the country and the SARS risk engine says there's no LOA available, then of course there's a certain reaction to that one. But where the SARS system indicates that indeed the LOA has been, a valid LOA has been issued and it is still valid and to the right applicant, then there's a different approach that we will follow. So these are some of the things that can do more to increase the regulatory focus. SARS inspections in legal methodology. Madam Chair, that all the products basically have to comply with legal methodology requirements, because almost every product has some amount of measure to it. For example, and we use this because it's a nice example with it, a liter of whiskey must have 1,000 milliliters in it. So legal methodology demands that when legal methodology demands that if the label says it's 1 liter of whiskey, then there must be a liter of whiskey in the bottle. Legal methodology further demands that whatever is considered as 1 liter in South Africa should be the same as India or China or somewhere elsewhere in the world. The 1 liter measure should be the same. So that's where we do our source inspections. We go to the ports of entry and we target the inspections, and we look. For example, recently we had to pull out some noodles that came from abroad, because they said they had 2 grams, but when we did the testing, there was 1.75 grams in those packets. So we had to send them back to the importer and say, look, you can either change that. If you can get 2 grams in, fine. If you can't, then you have to either repackage the product or you have to destroy it or send it back to the country of origin. So that's in the legal majority environment. In terms of amended certifications and VCs withdrawn, the one VC that we have withdrawn is the Coastos. You will recall, Madam, so we had come to the commentary previously. Coastos has fallen into disuse now, and although there's a limited number of Coastos in use, the regulatory cost of regulating the Coastos is, the cost benefit does not make sense. So that's one of the VCs that we could say that we have withdrawn. Amended, we have several in the automotive environment when it came to the use of the braking system. When you move from to more modern braking systems, then we had to amend the VCs to comply with this as well. So, Madam Chair, I think I've answered some of the questions, and I think it's easy with that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I'll just very quickly, as I said, I mean, on Honourable Lewis's question, which I think is really an important one, and I hope that we maybe have more time on the 14th. Go into a bit more detail, but for now, I think obviously, as Honourable Lewis will probably understand, as a founding member of GATT and WTO, obviously we don't we're not able to impose non-tariff barriers. But I think what he is asking about is the non-tariff measures, and I think that I definitely there has been a shift because of a range of developments that we have placed a greater emphasis on non-tariff measures. And in that, and I think the first thing to note is that South Africa is a very, very open economy, where I think we are very, very high levels of both import and export, that's over 20%. It's very high on world standards. If you take the US, 11% of its GDP that it imports. So we've got, but also we have a serious problem that since 1994, since we've opened up to the global market, because we were a very protected and very secure market prior to 1994, there has been a massive flood of both illegal, under-invoiced, and non-compliant goods into the South African market. It has changed because the world's global system has changed. As we know,
we are not along the pre-China and pre-rise of Asia into the world's trading system. So we've seen a massive increase. And I think our own, from our own security agencies, it is estimated that the illicit economy in South Africa is about 10% of GDP. So there's a massive amount of goods coming into it. The situation is also exacerbated over the past 3 years since the financial crisis, where, as we know, global demand has fallen, but there's still global oversupply. As we just, I mean, the clearest example is in every sector, but we've just seen that how it's almost destroyed our steel industry, where every country in the world, including the U.S., Europe, has to put in barriers. They've used tariff barriers and anti-dumping, but there is a flood of goods from Asia that could decimate, and it has already hollowed out. The U.S. manufacturing and European manufacturing is hollowed out. So there is an emphasis on, but I think what we are doing, and this also touches on Honorable McPherson's question about what are we doing. As I said, we have been working extensively on putting in place the risk-based system, where we must, and Lewis is absolutely right, we must, and we're trying to call them, let's say, long-established companies who have what we call legitimate imports. We must create measure. As I said, we have a track record of this, where we did it in the, where we set a task team with SARS with regards to the clothing industry, where they successfully ran this risk-based system, where certain companies who we know have a strong established record of having legitimate import, we create a system where they are quickly passed into the economy and so on. But I think we'll deal more change from our department, have been interacting with NRCA to put in place a system. Fortunately, also the new the Commissioner of SARS is also a former employee of the DTI's Industrial Development Division, so he also has our cooperation with SARS. We are reviving a task team with SARS to look at this issue of illegal imports. And as you know, there's also the establishment of the Border Management Agency. Every other country, the U.S. have put in place an entire new department, Homeland Security, to protect the borders, not only against movement of people, but, as I said, they have strong, strong systems to ensure that you have no illegal imports. So we have to up our game. Just in terms of what we have done with regards to Jody, we'll report on the specifics about the performance. But I think Honorable McPherson, maybe 2.5 years, I think when, as I said, the first agency when I became the DG 5 years ago, the first person, the NRCS was in serious crisis and underperformance. And the first CEO that was dismissed there and suspended and dismissed was in the NRCS because there was some massive problems there. So I think since then, and since the appointment of Mr. Moodley, we have seen a substantial turnaround. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done, but the institution is back to where it was. As you know, we've got NRCS comes out of SAS, which is since 1945. It is one of the first standard organizations globally. We've got very high standards in this country. We've got a very, very good system, a legacy system. So I think, but as I said, Jody will show that we are working actively to ensure that they had optimal performance in terms of the NRCS. I think I wanted to just comment on Honorable Mantash, who has left, but on the question of the gambling machines, yes, as I said, there have been actually, this is, we will definitely ask the team to work on it, but I did understand we were working with Grand Trade Investments in the Western Cape. We launched the, where they were busy manufacturing the gambling machines, and I don't know which ones, and that could be the, I don't know, maybe these new bingo type machines or others that we look at, but we will definitely look at that issue. And then just finally, it came out of the presentation around the revenue system and the advice of the AG, which was reported by the CFO. I think what we've said, the minister's guidance is very clear to all our agencies on this one, that whilst we are a democracy, all opinions are not equal. And we say that we must follow after vigorous debate and engagement, we must follow the opinion of the Auditor General. And that, so, on with regards to this revenue model, We've had a number of engagements with the AUG and with the NRC, and we have asked them to address this problem along the lines suggested by the Auditor General. So we do expect them to comply, and that hopefully this will be the last year that we get a qualified audit because of the revenue system. We understand there's no issue of mismanagement or anything. It's a technical system that they must put in place for us to accurately record and measure our revenue, and that they need to put in place that system. We've done it successfully at CIPC, which had the same problem. There was the absence of a proper robust system to record the revenue. The thing I'll just hand over to Joe.
DG. Thank you, G. In response to Honourable Hill Lewis, the ESA system for managing performance, I think DG is saying we assess the all of the performance of the entities on a quarterly basis and annually. I think in this past financial year, 2015-16, we have seen a trend where the performance of one or two of our entities is dipped below 80%. We've put in teams in place to work with the entities. I think one of the issues we've raised with the NRCS talks to the KRAs. I think they, in the last year, had about 28 KRAs. And we were saying we need to really look at those. Are those strategic enough and is it accurately reflecting the mandate and the work of the NRCS? Minister meets biannually with each of his, the commissioners, the CEOs, everybody who reports directly into him. And then there are quarterly meetings around performance with the MPs, the line divisions, and then the governance office in the DG's, the governance unit in the DG's office. One of the things that the DDG IGD has also instituted is quarterly meeting with all of the CEOs of technical infrastructure institutions to look at the actual performance and to unlock any kind of issues that are affecting the proper implementation of IPAP. Just in relation to the work that the Minister has offered around the clean audit and the technical qualification, he's asked both myself and the CFO and the Auditor General to convene a team together with the Audit Committee Chair of the DGI, who is also the Audit Committee Chair person of the ARCS, to see how we can actively deal with this matter. But the ESA system in place to look at this, and then the Minister also, each of the key loss areas are scored, and so underperformance is dealt with at an individual level in that particular way. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Thank you very much for those explanations, which I'm not sure whether that was sufficient for members or not at this particular point. But before I take two hands on my list, just like ask you one thing on the compulsory specifications, one third question, Mr. Moodley. Some time ago, and unfortunately, Mr. Mkongi, the Honourable Mkongi, has just had to leave to see a doctor, but the issue was, which he raised on one of these oversight visits, I think it was him, was with respect to the heaters, which was raised 18 months, 2 years ago, that these were, you know, certainly published as blowing up in the faces of the users. And we learned from yourself that they, you know, didn't come under a national, you know, regulatory compulsory specs. They came just under SAS, etc. But we put it to you that this clearly demonstrated in something that was risky for the user and should be covered. And you remember you indicated that you would look into the matter. Perhaps you can also share with us how far that has gone in this financial year. On my left was the Honourable Hill Lewis, and I saw another hand, actually saw two, right, the Honourable MacPherson. Is there anyone else? No. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. DG, I'd just like to press you a little bit on the answer you gave. You may have noticed that there was a bit of a contradiction between yourself and the CEO. The CEO says that their mandate is very clear. It is to protect consumers, to enforce the specifications, and to ensure free trade. Absolutely agree with that mandate. What I mean from what you said is that there is, in fact, a strategic move by the DTI to try and increase non-tariff measures, as you call it, where you can. Now, I just want to ask it again directly. Do you see the NRCS LOA application process as being used strategically as a non-tariff measure to keep us imports, or do you see their mandate as limited to what the CEO has said? Very, very direct and clear question. Then on to the CEO, again, I agree on that mandate. The key thing is if we agree that that's your mandate, you've got to do that effectively and efficiently. And that is what I fear is not happening at the moment. And the thing, this is the second or third time in a meeting that you've said that the number of complaints that you receive indicates that you are performing well. I'm afraid that is not true. I mean, if, you know, everyone moans about having to pay tax, but those complaints are not valid because everyone has to pay tax. And the tax payment system is extremely efficient. So they may not like it, they may moan about it, but they have to do it. But that's not the case with an LOA. If it was an extremely efficient system where they were getting responses, people were answering the phones and the emails, and they were just moaning about the very existence of having to apply for an LOA, then I'd say yes, the complaints mean that the system is working. But when the nature of the complaints is that they've been phoning the NRCS for 30 days and no one answers the phone, they've been emailing 6, 10, 12 times and no one answers the emails, they've been waiting 9 months, that is not an indicator of effectiveness. That is an indicator of ineffectiveness and inefficiency. So you can't use the defense that all of these complaints show that we're being effective. You've actually got to look at the nature of the complaint. And the nature of the complaints when it comes to the LOA process do not indicate effectiveness at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable McPherson.
Chair, I'd just like to ask the CEO what the current backlog of LOAs is and what has been done to meet that. I mean, I'm not speaking for industry as much as the Honourable Williams would like to suggest that I am, but I mean, I hesitate to guess when you said, you know, people, you know, complain about, you know, the cost of levies that they have to pay. You know, much like the example of tax, if you go to Sweden, people pay a lot of tax. They don't complain about it because they get a lot for it. People in South Africa complain about paying tax because they pay a lot of tax and they see little for it and they see a lot of being wasted. Now, I think that in your instance, people are frustrated about the levies they are paying because they are seeing the inefficiencies that exist. And I think the flip side of that is that if you increase levies and there was a correlated increase in service or increase in turnaround, I think that business would be prepared to take that on board and say, you know what, there's a reasonable trade-off. And I think that it's something that you should be speaking to your stakeholders about, because that is a potential solution, but it can't be more money for less or the same service. Now, when it comes to communication, the NRCS seem to be quite contradictory in things that they tell people, and this is what causes the frustration. So I'll use, for example, and I will send you the complaint after today, that an importer of industrial equipment that is used in bakeries is told by a number of people in the NRCS that they do not require an LOA because it is used in industrial use, and the VC that they quote, 8055, says that it is only required for ordinary persons, and so they gone on to argue that in fact the equipment that is used is not used by ordinary people, it is used by trained, specialized people in controlled environments, and therefore the LOA is not applicable to them. So they ship the goods, it arrives, and there's someone waiting at the port and says, what are you doing? You need an LOA for this. The inspector arrives and says, yes, now you're going to need the LOA for this. For 3 months, 5 million rand worth of machinery has had to be bonded in storage, which the importer has to pay the cost of.
on to put it into the factories that are required. That's a big problem. And unfortunately, Mr. Moody, the NRC office, you know, hasn't provided the information or the feedback or the continual contact. And in business, continual contact is vital. One email and one phone call is not sufficient. There must be continual contact. So that is, I think, a good example of how inefficient the system can be. And we want to make the system work.
Absolutely.
We don't have to protect a segment of society or a segment of industry. We want the system to work so that the economy can work.
Absolutely.
So I will send that to you. I hope you can deal with it. And I really don't think it's acceptable that the risk-based management services are coming to us in September. It should be in with us now. It's not here now. I think that that's something that the NRC has needed to actually take on board.
Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. Well, if we hadn't have had elections, we would have had, you know, been able to deal with a lot more work. But we are democracy, people's constitutional democracy, therefore we do have elections. They were just longer than we all expected, 3 months. So that we must just accept is what happens in a democracy. However, with respect to some of these points that you have raised, I just want to re-emphasize so that it's quite clear. In the past, we've tackled issues like the tires, which we were informed about, and I was under the impression that all these tires were coming from the east, as it were. I do see your hand. And only to learn that, yes, they do come from the east, but also overseas, or what one would call the west, as it were. And part of the problem, which producers or manufacturers of certain products don't realize, they don't intentionally manufacture an unsafe product, but the product may be built for a very cold climate. And the same product, a very hot climate, or a climate with sharp variations in the day, actually is unsafe. Not that that was taken account of. And as we all know, there have been several challenges in that regard. And I think a lot of good work was done by the NRCS in that respect. Much more does need to be done, but a lot has. The other issue is that we hear of items coming into the country, large items. And, you know, one of my leisure activities is to watch some of these sort of border crime shows, and it's quite clear overseas that they have serious challenges in this regard. The bulkier the furniture, the more serious the problem. So when they see a bulky piece of furniture, they don't automatically assume that that's what it is. And you would think, yes, it is. It can't be anything else. They see a child's doll, they don't take it at face value, because yes, it could be stuffed with drugs, etc. So in this modern age, we've had to become a lot more cautious and perhaps put measures in place that do delay goods. And it's a question of, are you going to allow things to creep in that way, or are you going to take extra measures? And I do believe what the committee is saying is we want those measures to stay, but we are concerned about the potential negative impact it may have, you know, on business per se. Having said that, I do want to just recognize, because I need to also take his hand, we have someone here from the European Union, if I'm not mistaken, or the European Union Chamber of Commerce, who has been in the committee before and shared certain things with us, and that is this correct, Mr. Stefan Sakoshek? Is that right?
Yes, it is, Mrs. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm using this platform because I think we've been making constructive comments and engaging quite actively with NRCS over the last few months and as part of the committee, and we're coming to near conclusion with the next meeting on the 14th. So what I'm saying is, my name is Stefan Sakoshek. I represent the EU Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And via the Chamber, we represent European industry on the ground. That's 2,000 companies, and I think we're well known by now. And I think we're all experiencing the same frustrations with the LOAs. It's nothing new there. We simply addressed this suggestion to the ETI and to the NRCAs, is that there is a simple way. Today, where South Africa has now joined, or has joined the WTO in terms of ratifying the trade facilitation agreement, there are rules of engagement for international trade which are applicable. And there's a very simple yet effective solution to be utilized, which we've suggested again and again. And we'd only suggest and request that consideration be given to our suggestion that as part of the risk-based approach program, we have a measure called verification of conformity of those goods that we're talking about prior to goods arriving in SA. It's a method which is currently used. Most bureaus of standards outsource some of their functionalities to conformity assessment bodies worldwide. In other words, we avoid the funnel effect. We're sitting in a situation where we have 7,000 containers a day, give or take, who arrive to Durban, and no one with the best of the capability, that's NRCS, SAP, SARS, everybody together, cannot digest that. It's just too much volume. So we're suggesting a simple additional measure within the risk-based assessment program or risk-based approach program, which is what we call a certificate of conformity. So it's requesting the importer, and this is helpful for the South African industry as well. It's leveling the bank fields. We're not being discriminatory against this or that country or this or that importer. We're just simply saying that according to WTO rules, we're very well allowed to say, as DTI and South Africa, that goods must be conformed to South African standards before they get here. And we've heard the notion of territoriality, of the responsibility of the SLS before. I understand that when Ms. Amudi talks about the source of the product is not the port of entry. The source of the product is actually the country of origin where the goods are manufactured. And there are methods to do that. There are factory audits, there's inspection consignment-based assessments, and all inspections, random inspections, whichever methodology we choose ultimately. So the big principle is that something has to be done right now, even if it's a short-term freedom measure, to protect the goods or to verify conformity of the goods, before they get to Urban when it's too late. That's my suggestion to the staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We always welcome these proposals. Did you want to come there, please, DG? Yes, all right. Just one moment, please. Honourable Mantashi, the DG did look for you when he was making the response.
I just want to ask a question. I hear what the EU says, but I'm asking a question. When it suggests that there should be outsourced weight, who's going to pay for that outsourced conformity board or committee? At whose expense does that come to count?
I think the DG may have some ideas himself. Yes, thank you.
Yes, I think just to deal with Anwar Yilmaz's point, as I said, I thought maybe we use the 14th. But I think, as I said, the NRCS CEO have answered, and of course, they are a regulated body, and he gave the correct answer. What I was asking is, as DTI from a policy point of view, and to explain again, I mean, and maybe just for the general audience about tariff and non-tariff, as we know, for example, in the clothing industry, it used to, in the 80s, it had a tariff of 100%. So it was very simple. We protected the industry using a tariff barrier. So nobody could really import to us because the cost would be raised by 100%, so our local industry could compete. So there was tariff barriers. Of course, now the tariff, because of the WTO negotiations and GATT, that tariff is now 45%. And for many items, it's 10% and so on. So you can no longer, and as I said, we fully endorse the view that we must protect and support local industries. The only way you can create jobs. But, so tariff barriers are no longer the legitimate law. You can no longer use that tool because of WTO arrangements. So therefore, we must use a range of other tools to ensure that we have less imports than exports in the country. So we make no apology that our only goal as a DTI is to support the local industry and to support our exporters, just like the gentleman of the EU is doing. His job is to support EU exporters. My job is to support South African exporters. But the issue is about trade, fair trade and unfair trade. We only participate in fair trade. So when we use non-tariff measures, we use the legitimate
instruments available to us to protect the South African consumer from non-compliant goods and to protect our industry from under-invoicing and from flux of imports. So as we've explained what we did in the steel industry, in the first stages we reduced the tariff from 10% to zero because we wanted to add competition in the domestic market because we had a monopoly playing the market. When the conditions changed and our steel industry was going to be destroyed, we raised the tariff to 10% again. So as I said, it depends on the need of the global environment and our own domestic industry guides, EDI's policy. But the mandate of the NLC is never changes. They must follow the act of protecting the consumer. I think again on the gentleman from the EU, I think as I said, we've received your correspondence, and as I said, we definitely have tasked our Gosrachen and Schengen is working for us to ensure that we do what we call, as I said, and most of the EU companies would fall under that, and US companies, what we call long established importers into our market, sometimes it's just components they import, they assemble it here and so on, and we agree to create a fast-track mechanism for dealing with that. But I want to also say to you that there's reciprocity here. Just like you delay our exports to products and create a range of non-tariff barriers for black stocks, you must also give us the privilege that has been given to you today to address our parliament, for us to also address your parliament. We have stopped from addressing your parliament on this issue. So I think it's just reciprocity. But as I said, our duty is to protect South African exporters and South African domestic producers.
Thank you very much, DG. I think you have responded already, haven't you, Mr. Moodley? Or not? Have you completed your responses?
And I would like to respond on one.
Yes.
On the first one, with regard to the heaters, Madam Chair, I think electric heaters are regulated. The question was on the generators at that point in time. Yes, and we have moved with regard to the VCs on the generators. On the terms of effectiveness and efficiency, I believe there will always be a difference of opinion between me and industry when it comes to effectiveness and efficiency. Because I measure my effectiveness and efficiency to the extent that I can regulate safety critical products and I can keep them off the marketplace. Industry will always measure my efficiency to the extent of the quickness which I can give LOEs. But that's not my mandate. Our mandate is very clear. Let me repeat. Our mandate is to protect the consumer and the environment from unsafe, non-compliant products and to promote fair trade. So there will be that a difference of opinion, but we take it into consideration. And as the DG went to some extent to say that we are working, and in fact we have worked on the mechanism to recognize those importers who have a good track record, and we are in the process of implementing it. We will come on the 14th of September with information on how we are implementing that. So I want to say that. What is current backlog? I will get that. We will give the statistics to you. We'll break them down in terms of the years. In terms of the industrial equipment, I did receive that email from Honorable McPherson, but I referred to my general manager. However, there is something that there's been a difference of information that has been provided from the answers, and of course I will welcome that information from Honorable McPherson, and I will investigate it further. There should be no difference of information because we work according to a set of capacity standards and technical regulations, so I will look into that further. And then with regard to the CBC, I think DJ has given the answer. Thank you.
Come in or not? No. All right. And that's fine. That's fine. On my left, this is your final question. A minute, please. We're at 11 or after.
Thank you. The DG is being a little bit deliberately evasive, but I understand why, and I can read between the lines. But I just want to has there been any instruction from the DGI to the NRCS to use the LOA application process as a non-tariff measure? Simple question. To the CO, look, I mean, if you understand your mandates completely excluding any reference to time frames or efficiency, then that is a misunderstanding of your mandates. You know, it's not good enough to say to SARS, your job is to collect tax. But if you take 10 years to do it, well, then that's fine, because as long as you collect the tax, of course efficiency and effectiveness come into the mandate. So it's not good enough to say, you know, if you think that it's acceptable to not answer someone's email for months at a time, or never answer a phone call, that is not acceptable. That's never going to be acceptable to this committee, and that is not the definition of effectiveness and efficiency, and it never will be. So, with respect, your understanding of your mandate is wrong if you think that it carries no responsibility to be efficient.
No, I didn't get that understanding, but there we are. CEO. Now, I said, I'm sure I did not get that same understanding. But anyway, again, I'm turning to the NRCS, and you want to respond to the comment? No. But I think, Honourable Hill Lewis, I myself have never known the DG to ever be deliberately evasive. I think that was somewhat stronger than is the case. You would like an answer to the question, has the DG, is it the DG or the NRCS? Who are you referring to? Has the DG or the NRCS given an instruction? Which one?
Has the DTI ever instructed the NRCS, or does it view the LOA application process as one of the non-tariff measures that the DG is referring to?
Well, let's stick to the word instruction, because that's how it was worded.
Yeah, well, if to be then as precise as I can, the DTI, whether from the DG or the minister, has never given any instruction to the NRCS. What the minister has done on all our quarterly meetings, he has given them a firm instruction to be tough on non-compliant goods. He has repeated it in every meeting. We have to be tough on substandard, non-compliant and dangerous goods. That is very hard on that, but never ever has he asked them to use it as a tariff barrier.
Thank you. I think nothing could be more clear-cut from that statement. Thank you very much, DG, Mr. Lionel October. But I must say, this reminds me of something I encountered in Australia, visiting my youngest daughter a couple of years back. I used to think we were a pretty compliant society, generally speaking, and I certainly thought I was a compliant person in every respect. And I realized from the Australians I wasn't compliant according to their interpretation, because I regarded an orange light as, well, there's nothing coming, go through. It simply means caution, be more careful. They say, yes, we found out that is how the South Africans think. But no, it is not the Australian interpretation. Caution does not mean see if you can get through, but rather stop in your tracks. But it gives the opportunity for everything to stop, which is why they have an almost zero stat on that interception collision. So I said, well, I apologize. I'm new in your country, second day driving, an international license. I shall in future remember that. Of course, I was given a caution or a warning and allowed to continue on my way. But I'm simply using that to illustrate interpretations of compliance. Because I notice you here today, very interesting people coming in, or agencies and companies. We've got, you know, people from, as we got, the EU was one of them there. We had someone from the Old Mutual, as far as I could see. We had even Fashini's represented here. We had Debt Busters. I'm not sure why they would be interested in this particular presentation. But if you're looking at busting debt, come and talk to us, because I'm interested in seeing that the banks actually implement the NCA, the Act of 2007. That's about compliance as well. And they may be looking at this as more like an orange light. I'm not. I see it as a red light. Standard Bank Group are even here. So I see some very interesting people.
a lot of consultants in this area. Numerous consultants. Yes, thank you. Anyway, thank you very much for being here. You are all very welcome, and we do welcome input. We are a people's democracy, and I think the most democratic country internationally. On that particular note, I'd like to thank the NRCS, and I think you're now aware of some of the questions that you will be facing on the 14th, and we'd obviously like you to come fully prepared to respond. Thank you very much, you and your team. And then I know that the DG will be remaining, and I hope the Scots will be remaining, and we're going to be, after a 5-minute comfort break, those who would like some tea, it's outside, we will be having the National Credit Regulator. Thank you very much. So let's try and make it 3 minutes.
Thank you.
we've got the National Credit Regulator, which is obviously why the debt busters are here. They sat through the National Regulator for compulsory spends and so on. And it's a term which we may even think of drafting into the NCA, some sort of compulsory specification. But on that note, we really would like to welcome, I've already indicated that the CEO, Ms. Machigari, is with us today, the CFO, Ms. Mafuleka, and of course Mr. Obed Tongwane, the Deputy CEO, and the DG is staying with us yet again. Now, the reason why there's so few of us, because I know we are very interested in this area, is unfortunately because our WIP has been redeployed to communications, so we don't have our WIP with us. We all serviced Kernhoff. Honourable Kernhoff has gone to Science and Technology. He sits on two committees. And the Honourable Mkongi, as you can see, has an allergy and he's gone back to the doctor. So it isn't because people do not wish to be here, but rather other reasons. And the Honourable Shivambu is dealing with, he is also the senior whip in his party, dealing with other matters thereof. Fine. On that note, can you please begin your presentation? Thank you, CEO.
Good morning, and thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable members, and the DG, and the Group COO of the DPI. I'm going to present the fourth quarter financial and non-financial performance information that's ending March 2016, and just to give you the NCR the overview of the presentation, those are the topics that I'm going to cover. NCR programs as a snapshot, the fourth quarter performance report, consumer education enforcement, and the fourth quarter financial report, which will be presented by the CFO. Just to quickly take you through the NCR programs for the last financial year. To promote responsible credit granting, protect consumers from abuse and unfair practices in the consumer credit market and address open indebtedness, to enhance the quality and accuracy of credit bureau information, to improve NCR's operational effectiveness, and to ensure effective implementation of the National Credit Amendment Act. We know that most of the regulations, you know, became effective in 2015. Now, in terms of the first program, which is to promote responsible credit granting, the output is to improve compliance with affordability assessment regulations. These regulations came into force in September 2015, and the fourth quarter milestone was to conduct a workshop. We conducted four workshops in that quarter in the Northwest, Gauteng, Mpumalanga, and the Free State provinces. And in terms of the number of provinces to visit to monitor compliance and take appropriate enforcement action, and this is with regard to the affordability assessment regulations, two provinces were visited, and this was in Gauteng and Western Cape. In terms of promoting, further promoting responsible credit granting, we also look at compliance around the cost of credit, the total cost of credit. We were required to conduct 5 investigations. We conducted 11 investigations, and this was in Limpopo and Gauteng. We covered those provinces, and mainly this was through the raids that we conducted in partnership with the South African Police Service. We've since also taken enforcement action against these credit providers. Some of them were arrested, criminal cases opened. We issued compliance notices in respect of some of those credit providers and referred some to the National Consumer Tribunal. With regards to SO2, which is the second program to protect consumers from abuse and unfair practices in the consumer credit market and address over indebtedness, We conducted 21 investigations on reckless lending, and this again was through the rates, the same rates that we conduct. We normally don't just look at one issue. We look at the number of issues. We take a sample of credit agreements, and we look at the number of issues which would touch on areas around affordability assessment regulations, whether those were complied with. We look at reckless lending and so forth, and that's the reason why we've been able to exceed targeting those areas. And in terms of enhancing the quality and accuracy of credit bureau information, we conducted investigations on two credit bureaus. They have since complied. What we did was we issued instructional letters to them. But we also receive on an annual basis audited reports from the auditors of these credit, the 14 credit bureaus that are registered with the NCR. Six entities from that investigation were referred to the investigations department. Instructional letters were sent to some. One credit bureau voluntarily cancelled the registration, which we are challenging. And the other credit bureau was referred to the National Consumer Tribunal. And in terms of improving NCR's operational effectiveness, which is program four, for the fourth quarter, we exceeded target. 100% of uptime availability on our IP system, and this is as a result of the network monitoring tool that we have designed that enables prediction of network failures to avoid downtime. But if you look at that on an annual basis, the actual achievement was about 99.1%, but for the fourth quarter we exceeded the target. And in terms of the fifth program, which really talks to the amendments, we were required to conduct 12 workshops to improve awareness of the amendments and compliance with those amendments. We achieved that target. 12 workshops were conducted. And in terms of the number of multimedia awareness campaigns, we exceeded target in the sense that we had 15 radio and TV interviews that were conducted, and this is as a result really of the fact that you will recall that the affordability assessment regulations came into effect in September 2015, and in May 2016 the interest rates and fees were also going to be published, and a lot of those interviews were really around those regulations. Again, in terms of improving awareness and compliance, we had three exhibitions instead of two for the fourth quarter. And in terms of conducting special investigations and taking appropriate enforcement action, in terms of the number of raids that we conducted around, again, the published regulations, we conducted a raid in the Limpopo province. So that's supposed to be fourth quarter milestone, not third quarter. We conducted a raid in the Limpopo province. 11 entities were raided. This is, we did that in partnership with the South African Police Service. 11 people were arrested and criminal cases opened, and ID books, bank cards, and social cards were seized. Now, I would just like to take you through what we have been busy with, since January this year to date. With regard to consumer education and enforcement, we conducted what we call education campaigns around Know Your Credit Status, which we conducted jointly with the credit bureaus and the Credit Bureau Association. And this we did the shopping centers with the GDI staff, the South African Revenue Service staff, and I think after the financial year, we also conducted a similar exercise with the University of South Africa. We worked jointly with the local travel authorities in rural areas such as Kwa, the Free State, Hadikagen in Boko, Escort in KwaZulu-Natal, Taun in Northwest, George in Western Cape, and Kwamhlanga in Mpumalanga province. This is an outreach program, the business that we've been conducting throughout the country, and specifically targeting you know, or looking at pensioners and other social grant recipients to educate them about their rights and responsibilities, and to create awareness related to some of the undesirable practices that some service providers, you know, especially retailers, have been engaging in. So I have been involved in those individuals. We've been helping to those rural areas, and we will continue to do that. In the next 2 weeks, we will be going to the Northern Cape, but we are mainly looking at, you know, going to rural areas and hence working, you know, together with local tribal authorities in conducting those community outreach programs. We have since referred 20 meters to the National Consumer Tribunal. Close 20 meters where investigations were conducted and no contraventions were identified. We investigated 72, we conducted 72 investigations, and again these are raids, you know, where we raided national lenders. Some of the contraventions that were identified in these raids had to do with the fact that they were overcharging consumers, you know, retaining ATM cards and then engaging in reckless trading and so forth. At this point, Honourable Chair, I will hand over to the CFO. Thank you.
Thank you to the CEO. A very good morning to the Honourable Members, and Honourable Chairman, the DG of the GTI, and the Group COO from the GTI, and all the members who are here. Just to quickly take through the members on the our fourth financial performance, fourth quarter financial performance. The results, can just start for the benefit of the members, that the results for the fourth quarter are cumulative. So it covers the period from the 1st of April 2015 up until the 31st of March 2016. The overall financial performance for the MCR is as follows. For our total income, the actual versus the budget, we have the negative variance of about 18%. The reason being, when you look at our fees from the registrants, we under-collected by 41% the budgeted. The main reason really is the fact that when we budgeted for the revenue, we were in anticipation of the regulations of the removal of the threshold for the registrations of our credit providers. Unfortunately, the regulations, they were only published early this year. So we're hoping that more registrants will come to our net hands, increase revenue or income. For the transfer from the DTI, we received what it was allocated to us, and towards the end of the quarter, we were given an additional 1 million for that. And when you look at our other income, where our actual exceeds budget, the other income comprises of the royalties from the utilization of a national loan rate, which is the NLR, as well as the other income that we have received from the utilization of the PA interest, PDA, we will say for the payment distribution agencies. So this is not additional funding per se, but this income is only earmarked for consumer education and investigation. Moving on to our expenditure lines, the MCR spent within the budget, we were, you know, about approximately 4% within the budget, which is the positive variance. Yes, it was not an easy, you know, it was not easy to control our costs per se, but because we had to make sure that we contain our costs so that our revenue line is aligned to our cost line. Hence, there's been some savings that was, in the form of efficiencies that we tried to push, and we really achieved, because all our program cost, we made a saving of about 21.5% against the budget, because we had to be creative and looked at, push more efficiencies. Just a typical example, we looked at the cost around the traveling, where then we said, instead of department flying for investigation and so forth, we looked at how, we can utilize the group, where the group targets, go to more or less the same areas, and where we looked at if the team is going to go out, say, conduct compliance visit or break and so forth, we look at the towns that are better along the borderlines of the province, so that, they can just have two provinces to go. And also, focused on making sure that the teams that go out there, at least they do, if possible, they just do in and out of town. Because really traveling was one of our core drivers as well. The administrative cost, the members, they might see that there's a negative variance of about 29.5%. Actually, on the line item, there's a saving. But because of depreciation that we have, which is a non-cash item, that is not budgeted for. But if you were to remove depreciation of about 6 million, then you will see that the picture changes. So as it stands, as far as expenses are concerned, we stand to be within the budget. Around the capital expenditure, as I said earlier, our revenue line, because of the fees from registrants, where we under collected in commas there, we had them to try to push break or on our spending. Hence, we identified some of the capital expenditure items that we can do without for this financial year. So hence the savings there as well, where we only spend about 44% of our total budget on the expenditure. So thank you. I will hand over to the CEO.
Thank you very much. Are you the only one who will be talking to this presentation, CEO, and your CEO? Is that it? Honourable Chair, we also have the Deputy CEO with us. Yeah, but yes, we are done. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, members, we heard the presentation, and we check by a show of hands. Right, we have the Honourable Hill Lewis, the Honourable Montash, the Honourable McPherson, and the Honourable Williams.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Mojokara. Nice to see you again in that committee. A couple of things that we always like to talk about. Firstly, last time you were here, you gave us an update on some of the big cases. If you can do so again, you'll know that I wrote to you around the Clapton matter, and I did receive your response last week that you have settled with Clapton for the amount of 2 million rand. I wanted to raise that with you here because while I appreciate what you said in the response about settlement often being a far more efficient way to resolve these conflicts and a more efficient use of your resources, the settlement amount is extremely low for a company like Capfin, a company the size of Capfin, but also a company that was doing what Capfin was doing. So it doesn't fit the size of the company, nor does it fit the size of the crime. And so, while
indicators you are raising it here, the it is what? What is it?
2 million rand.
No, but you said so. What it? The work was. You indicated it may have been wrong. What was wrong? I don't know.
I can read exactly what they were doing. I'll just have to find and apply again now, but serious transgressions, and we've raised this in the past with African Bounty and with Lewis. A lot of this is not new. I've raised before with you the concern that the targets that you set yourself are quite generous in the sense that they're not exactly stretch targets. So in the past we've discussed the need, I think, for a dedicated team of enforcement officers to be doing raids on a daily basis around the country. So while we welcome 11 raids having taken place, that's, you know, 11 raids in comparison to the scale of what we know the problem is a drop in the ocean. Of course that is a resourcing concern, and I'm glad that the COO and the DD are here, but really given the scale of the illegal credit market in South Africa, a dedicated full-time enforcement officer team is necessary. The COO spoke earlier about how they meet regularly to review whether the targets are strategic enough. I would submit that some of the targets in the NCR are quite easily attainable, and they're not exactly stretch targets. I think I'll leave it at that for the first round, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. We accept we welcome the presentation, Mr. Chairperson, but we would be very glad if all provinces are visited by your team to get the address lending that is added to, in particular, the old age pensioners by the low service administration. But I also want to pose a question. Is non-compliance only a problem of LOSHA and not the formal banks that we have? Because I have an experience of being overcharged, or some other people being overcharged on the interest that on their transaction. And if that happens, when you put penalties on them, what do you do with the money that you get from those penalties? Who does it benefit? Because I'm not seeing it situated anyway or any report about it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mantash. Honourable Williams. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. Just to follow on from what my colleague had said, you know, the last time you were here, we were in the old assembly, and there was a list of cases that we had put together, or that you had disclosed to us. And one of the concerns I had raised, and I hope you're listening, Chair, is that there seems to be no interdepartmental coordination from the SAPS point of view, or from the judiciary, or from the prosecuting authority, at least, from actually taking these guys to court and following through with the cases. And we were assured that a meeting was going to take place, and I do hope that that meeting, that sort of prior meeting, will take place at some point. But CEO, I'm concerned that the settlement was so low, and I'm just wondering who took that ultimate decision to settle at a paltry 2 million rand, because it would seem a bizarre decision to take place.
I need to stop you there, Honourable MacPherson, because I do want to hear more and give you the time, but I asked before, I wanted to know what we're talking about. It has been raised by the Honourable Hill Lewis, and I thought, well, you're going to be dealing with the same thing. What is it we're dealing with? What regulation did they break? What didn't they comply with? You are raising the issue. Tell us what it is as a committee.
Would you like me to answer? Would you like to answer?
No, I'm asking the CEO.
Okay. So from the CEO's reply, they had identified 25 loans which in their mind constituted illegal loans or reckless lending. Those 25 examples had been referred to the tribunal. They agreed with Kaplan that those 25 loans would be written off, that the credit listings of those 25 consumers would be deleted, and that they would pay the 50 million rand. Now, one may argue that yes, you are dealing with 25 examples, but I think the original case that the NCR made was that those 25 were indicative of a much greater problem with Captain's method of.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, I think it's important to understand how that process unfolds. Then, my second point is something that I had raised with the CEO. I had written to her about, quite frankly, the harassment that I was receiving from a lady who was, you know, alleging that the NCR was acting irregularly. And, you know, thank you to the CEO who clarified to me what her status was and that she actually was not a bona fide ex-counselor, which concerns me because how wide is the extent of people, you know, purporting to be debt counselors and, you know, actually, quite frankly, ripping people off and putting people into more trouble. So I'd just like to get your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Honourable William.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question goes along your slide 13 on your financial performance. I'd just like to know why there's such a huge difference between the actual and budgeted from the fees section. It's nearly 54 million rand. Now, you did say that they changed some regulations or something, but for instance, next year, have you reduced your budget for that? You know, is that going to be the same next year? I just want to know, you know, about that 54 million rand difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. And is anyone else who wishes to raise a question in this regard? No. I have a couple myself, and that is with respect to the compliance. How does the NCR monitor compliance with affordability assessments by credit providers? And does the NCR conduct any investigations on the more formal credit providers per se? And this, as you know, is also related to the points we raised previously in the committee about the non-compliance of financial institutions with the 2007 Act. And what measures exist there so that you can pursue a follow-up? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, for this question. The matter of Captain, we had referred this matter to the National Consumer Tribunal more than a year ago. At the time when we entered into the settlement agreement with Captain, nothing had been done. In the meantime, consumers continued to be, you know, they continued to be exploited because there was no judgment. We therefore, you know, entered into the settlement agreement. And whenever we do that, what we basically look at are two principles for us. One is that you want to punish the entity. And secondly, you have to make sure that there is consumer redress. And there was, in this particular instance, there was consumer redress. We got cooperation from Captain. They cooperated with us. And this is one other thing that you ought to look at as a regulator, and it's also in the Act, to arrive at some quantum in terms of the, you know, settlement fee that the entity ought to pay. We may debate whether 2 million rand, you know, is not enough, you know, or not, but that was the amount that we finally, you know, settled on. Also basing this on the fact that they had also changed their TVS. If you look at their TVN now, it talks about the fact that a person will qualify for a loan only if they can afford it. So we look at all of those things for us to be able to arrive at the 2 million settlement fine. And therefore, we saw that as another, you know, quick win for consumers, to make sure that this consumer redress that is provided, you know, in a quick manner. Yes, the issue of our target not being stretched. The honourable members will recall that, you know, last year, you know, same sentiment was raised. We did increase, you know, our targets, and for that reason, in the latter part of last financial year, and we were still able to achieve, you know, most of those targets, because we decided to be smart about the way that we achieve these targets. But obviously, issues of capacity do really come into play. And to say that, you know, we will, you know, we are disengaging with the DPI to see where we can increase our resources. So that engagement is taking place. The questions from Honorable Mantas. All provinces will be visited. We are even going to go back to, you know, the provinces that we visited earlier. Because one province, if you look at Limpopo, for instance, we went to James, that's the first time. The second time we went to the Kale, they are huge. So the only way with the capacity that we have, the only way we can be able to reach, you know, a lot of these areas would be if we revisit, you know, these provinces. So that will be done. Now, in terms of interventions, it's across the board. We can never say just small fee providers that are not compliant. This cuts across, you know, all types of entities. So we do pick up contraventions in all, you know, in all areas, in a number of areas, and across different types of credit providers. The imposition of penalties, they end up in the state coffers. Unfortunately, we can't use those penalties. Whether they are imposed by, you know, us through the settlement agreements or imposed by the National Consumer Tribunal, but they end up in the state coffers. Yeah, the revenue fund. Honorable McFadden, in terms of the big cases that you referred to the NCT, and I take it your question really talks to taking directors or holding directors liable. If you recall with the African Bank matter, it was the responsibility of, you know, the Reserve Bank did that. And I would ask the deputy CEO perhaps to also touch on that. The complainant that the lady who sent the complaint to you, the poor team to be a death counselor when she wasn't a registered death counselor, we haven't really identified a lot of those cases, but you know that they're there. And every time we are alerted to practices like that, we act immediately, because especially in debt counseling, you know, the last thing that you want is for people to start collecting money from consumers and running. So those are some of the cases that we would prioritize if, you know, they are made known, you know, if we get to know about them as the NCR. I'll ask the CFO perhaps to also touch on the financial performance. But before I do that, let me also respond to the Honorable Chair's question around how we monitor compliance with affordability assessment regulations. Is that we do that through, on an annual basis, we receive assurance engagement calls from auditors and accounting officers of all credit providers that are registered with NCR, and that is where they would, you know, indicate areas of non-compliance, and one of which could be the fact that the credit provider does not do proper affordability assessments. But what we also do is that we would ask, we would normally write to the credit providers and ask for a sample of credit agreements that they entered into over a period of time. And from that list, we will get the sample that we would test. But we also do that during the time when you conduct rates. Our inspectors would go in and ask for a sample of credit agreements and test to see whether affordability assessments were conducted before the loans were extended. So we employ various measures or tools, if you like, Honorable Chair, to assess or look at whether the providers conduct affordability assessments. And that's what we do for, you know, the formal credit providers, informal ones that are not yet registered. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to respond to the question posed by Honorable William. Before I respond, I've just been reminded by the CEO here. Um, That's just my daughter clarified that the figures that we are presenting in the financial performance is the audited figures, and the audit for 2015 has been finalized, and the NPR achieved a clean audit once again. And on the revenue line, fees from the registering, the variance of actually the difference between the actual and the budget is 83 million. Okay. As I said, when we budgeted for 15-16 financial year, we had hoped that by then the regulations would have been published and approved. For the new financial year, which is that we are in now, 16-17, we did not increase our revenue. It's exceeding at 56 million as well. Probably we just increased it by a mere 1% because we still want to catch up on the benefits, that with the removal of the thresholds, increased revenue that we might get. However, if it is not only that, early this year around May, the regulation was also published on the increase of renewal fees, where we have also removed a cap on the branch fees. For example, with the bank, they would have to pay for renewal fee for each branch. So if they've got 6,000 branches, they would have to pay for 6,000 branches, whereas previously they were a cap. As long as there are more branches that are open, but if their fees comes to 300, and that's what they will, they will pay for, which translated to about they will start paying for 1,200 branches versus the extra number of branches that they have. So with the removal of that cap from the branch fees, then we hope that more revenue will come to the fore. The 56 million we have not reached on the debt target this year because the regulations we only published in May. So the registrants were already renewed before May, so they're not going to pay the increased fee. And there's also a proportionate that has taken place because what was said in the new regulations that all the registrants should pay the regulator on the 31st of July. So those ones were renewed after June to now, so they're not going to have a year, the full year. So they will only be paying for 11 months, 10 months, and so forth. So we might not get the 12 months worth of revenue for now. So I'm just sensitizing the committee that, yes, we might not 100% reach the 56 million.
While you're on that topic, what is the fee? Because it sounded like there's been a new fee. You know, you've explained the configuration has changed, but has the fee increased? The individual fee?
Yes, okay. The fee has really increased. How we charge for the fees or the renewal fees is the percentage based on the principal debt that has been dispensed by the credit provider. The increase, I think, it has been 10%. So if the bank the credit provider was paying 100,000 a year, so now on the new fee, it's 10% of that, which is 380. So yes, and we have also increased for the counselors as well, and we have removed, as I said, the cash on the branch fee.
I want the answer to convince me that it is justifiable to let the people who have conducted irregular deductions from customers by just imposing to them a penalty that is going into the coffers of the state. I'm fine with it. But those who have been robbed, who have been ripped, get nothing in terms of being reimbursed of the funds that have been taken from them. Isn't it that we're a government for the poor? Why are we always, being so soft to these people who were raping our people, broad daylight robbery of exorbitant interest on transactions done by the bank. And we are quiet, you know, saying we bank, reimburse those people that you have raped off. You only take money into the coffers in the form of penalties that you have imposed. What about those poor people who have been raped off?
Honourable Mantash, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know about this 2 million rand fine. I'm not familiar with the case at all, but I think the 2 million rand, it doesn't even sound like a punishment. It's a very small amount of money for financial institutions to pay for basically doing what was obviously wrong. And I'd like to know where you came up with this 2 million rand. Did they suggest it to you? I mean, maybe they, next time you can find them 100 rand, because it's such a low amount of money. The fine should be much higher than this. You know, it's actually a bit of an embarrassment to have 2 million rand fine for obviously, you know, committing financial fraud or whatever they did, but it's very bad, I think. You should charge them much more than that.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Zulu?
Yes, just an update, if you could, on the credit life legislation and regulations. And then, in the Lewis matter, are you considering joining the case as amicus curiae? I think it would be a really great opportunity to show the public what work and to show the court what work you are doing in that regard. And it's an important test case for the country, currently being pursued entirely privately by that gentleman, Mr. Willem. And I think it would be great for you to join as amicus curiae. I hope you consider doing that. And then credit life. Oh yes, and then the payment distribution authority. There's been some discussion about the fact that there's a cash flow, there's a cash crunch at the PDA. Can you comment on that?
Unfortunately, Honourable Hill, if the Secretary could not capture that, we would now ask you to repeat.
Which point?
The case itself he couldn't get.
Oh, the Lewis case.
Oh, I think he must have thought Hill, Lewis, and then, you know, he had a certain conclusion. No, and you know.
No relation whatsoever.
No, I'm sure. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you. CEO, are you not then compelled to criminally charge someone who purports to be someone that she's not? I really would ask that you get an opinion on the matter, because, and it goes back to, you know, what maybe the Honourable Hill-Lewis was referring to, or implying, is that for as long as people are allowed to get away with these things, whether it be reckless lending or whatever, or in my opinion fraud, they will continue to do so if the penalties are not harsh enough. So, I mean, a 2 million rand fine is not harsh enough, in my opinion. Allowing someone to act as a debt counsellor who is not, is in my opinion a criminal offence. And I think that the NGO needs to start being tougher with people that are ripping off ordinary South Africans. So I would really ask that you would get an opinion whether someone like that can be criminally charged, then if that opinion is favourable, that you would then proceed with that.
Very much, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, for those questions. The deductions, the overcharging for the overcharging consumers, in instances like that, we do demand that the credit provider fund the consumer. so consumers are able to get back what they were overcharged if it's instances where the grid provider overcharged them. So the money goes directly to the consumer in that particular instance. And we've had quite a number of cases like that where we get complaints. The complainant would complain that the grid provider charged him or her the interest that is more than what is, you know, stipulated in the act, and would normally ask the grid provider to refund the consumer. So that we do. Banking transactions don't unfortunately fall within our mandate, so that is for the Reserve Bank. I'll also respond to the Honorable Lewis's question around credit life regulations. We need to understand that the final regulations will be published soon, because the regulations are with between the DTI and the Department of National Treasury. So, but you know, there will be, I need to understand that there will be published very soon. I'm going to ask the Deputy CEO to respond to some of those questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it on Mr. Chongguani?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you, Honorable Members. Coming to the capital matter, maybe let me start off. No, Kevin, I'm sorry. Let me start off by putting things into perspective. All of us, I think, are aware of the fact that NCR is very passionate about discharging its mandate, which is consumer protection and tough enforcement of the act. At a certain stage, when we came to present to the portfolio committee, we were asked about the delays pertaining to the cases that we refer to the tribunal. And discussions were then indulged into, and the situation is that when, after referring a matter to the tribunal, the matter is basically outside of our control. And when you refer the institutions such as the banks to the tribunal, they hire or employ the best legal range that we have in the country. You find them having 2-3 SCs and junior advocates as well. And the sole purpose thereof is to try to frustrate and prolong the process as much as possible. They would raise technical issues. There would be pre-hearings and so forth. And the documentation would be challenged and so forth before we even come to the actual hearing of the matter. And the concern that some honorable members raised was that in the process, because there's no finality, consumer abuse continues. And there's nothing that you can do to stop those particular credit providers from continuing with that abusive practice as long as the matter is pending for the tribunal. And that was the challenge. And then we had to come up with alternative methods, especially after the Capitec decision. NCR referred Capitec to the tribunal and ultimately landed in the High Court, and NCR was criticized in all fairness. And the criticism by the Honorable Judge was that we are not engaging enough with our registrants. We are so much in a hurry to refer them to the tribunal, we don't even entertain listening to them when they come up with proposals and so forth, and that we should have listened to them first prior to being this harsh with them. So we had to realign and reposition ourselves as well, and this matter, like the CEO indicated, had been before the tribunal for more than a year. In the meantime, the abuse with consumers was happening. And we're talking about 25 loans. And the amounts that were involved as well into the respective credit agreements and so forth. So we thought that, or deemed it necessary that in engaging with them, one of the things that we have to be mindful of is whether or not we would achieve the same outcome before the tribunal. We have asked for further prayers in our papers, the reinvestment and refunds to the consumers, the delisting of those particular consumers and so forth and so on. And one should also bear in mind that as a tribunal, as an independent institution, is going to afford all the parties an opportunity to argue aggravation and mitigation of whatever sentence has to be meted out. And you're not guaranteed, even if you're to ask for whatever millions of rand, you're not guaranteed that you are definitely going to get that. So that's a risk as well. In a sense that even if you win at the tribunal, like if you take in, they appealed to the High Court. If we lose, the CR will do the same. We appealed to the High Court. If any of the parties is not happy with a High Court decision, you take it to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and so forth. So you find that actually it may even take 5 to 10 years before the matter is settled. In the meantime, what happens to the consumer? So we were trying to balance issues, and you look at the legal landscape and the practicalities of the situation and consumer protection, and we thought that it was feasible and reasonable for us to enter into a settlement, because then furthermore we had guarantees from the restaurant to say that they're going to desist from this particular behavior, and they will submit going forward audit reports on a regular basis to assure us that the practice is sealed. And as far as the Lewis matter is concerned, Honorable Lewis, we are seriously considering. I'm sorry, apologies. As far as the Lewis case is concerned, we are aware of the issues that are relating to the matter, and we are seriously considering joining an amicus curiae in the matter. And as far as the payment distribution agencies are concerned, we have put measures in place because now previously they were not legislated for, so we were governing the relationship through service level agreements, but now they are legislated for, and there are mechanisms in place such as quarterly audit and on-site inspection. So they submit quarterly audited reports to the NCR as far as the money that have been paid over to them for distribution to pay for either our consent. And to date, we haven't received anything untoward about cash cushions. As far as laying criminal charges is concerned with regards to people impersonating their counselors, let me also indicate that initially this particular conduct read in ugly face in Western Cape, and we conducted raids in December on most of the so-called debt handlers that were conducting that particular whatever exercise. The police were involved as well, and because it's fraud and it has to be investigated and so forth, and indeed from the NCR side we laid criminal charges as far as these people are concerned. And then from the NCR side, regulatory point of view, we also requested them to register to be the debt counselors, because some of them indicated that they have seen an opportunity to, but they don't know that they need to be registered. And the lady that you referred to, Honorable McPherson, the investigation is still ongoing, and indeed we will also lay criminal charges after conclusion thereof. I think I have covered most of the ones that I have.
Thank you very much, Deputy CEO. I just wanted to sort of tackle that and get some point where we could say it's not completed, it's still ongoing, but it would be a suitable point to leave at the moment. One of the questions I have, though, is what you referred to on slide 6, the fourth quarter performance report and the strategic one output to protect consumers from abuse and unfair practices in the consumer credit market and to address over-indebtedness. You refer here to 21 investigations on reckless lending completed. These 21 investigations, are we looking at
the formal sector, registered sector, in other words, banks and financial institutions, or perhaps we're looking at the practice which we identified some years ago, in which furniture companies also have the capacity in some way to lend money and so on. Now, exactly what are we talking about? What sort of reckless lending are we talking about here? The other point is, in relation to the FICA, as far as the NPR is concerned, we're aware that the FICA is under National Treasury, okay, finance. But on the other hand, there is a relationship, and that it does indicate when you FICA, if someone FICA something, they indicate what their salary or remuneration or income is, along with their ID. There is a relationship then with the NPR, as you can see, which is also a question of a loan. You borrow funds from a bank or some institution, and you're required to inform them of your remuneration, not so. Now, in the case of FICA, this would appear to be very much a one-off. In the case of the NPR, and I just want this clarity, for each loan undertaken, you require that respective lender to clarify the earnings or the remuneration of the applicant. I just want to get that quite clear. All right. The other question was in relation to page or slide 7. Not applicable strategic point 3 to enhance the quality and accuracy of credit bureau information and increase compliance by credit bureaus in respect of consumer credit information, which is also a point raised by the committee. And actual achievement, not applicable. 6 entities were referred for investigation in the first quarter. Instructional letters sent, 1 credit bureau voluntary cancelled registration, 1 credit bureau referred to the NCT. But there were 6 entities. So I'm just trying to tie that up. Thank you. My apologies, Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, no, I keep going back to this client situation, but I just want to say that the fact that you said that nothing could be done while the case was before the tribunal, and that the company involved were just going to keep throwing money at the problem until eventually settled at a tiny amount of 2 million rands, the problem here then is the system that's in place to deal with the situation. And it is Parliament that creates systems in South Africa when it comes to these sort of things. So I'd like the NCR to make proposals to this committee on how this committee can try to stop this behavior, so that when the NCR finds non-compliance and then, you know, takes action against really big financial providers, and then what they do is they just hold you up in court forever, somehow we can get around this, or else you won't be able to do this. It's the principle of it, not the amount of the 25 loans. It's the principle that they can behave as they please and only pay a very small fine because they have the resources to keep government in court forever and cost us a massive amount of money. So I'd like you to come up with proposals that we can now start addressing this, what seems to be quite a big problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. Yes, I'm just looking behind you, Honourable Hillewis. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to agree with Honourable Williams. I think there are one of two ways that you can address the problem, and that is to make an amendment to the legislation to empower you to issue a compliance order like the National Consumer Commission, whereby those who have received the compliance order must abide by it. The only way that they can actually then appeal that order must actually that they go to court themselves and have it set aside. And another point is that you can also at the moment apply for interim relief at the courts and ask for an interdict. And I think you must see whether you can get legal advice on that issue, whether you can actually apply for an interdict to stop people from trading or to stop them from trading on certain aspects depending on the scope of the problem. So I'd just like you to investigate those two aspects. Thank you.
Now, there is a question directed to DTI. Would you like to address it first, DD, or yes, Ms. Cole?
Thank you, Chair. I think if I got the question correctly, it was Heather Lewis around, Honourable Heather Lewis about the top topic. I think we, as the department, we've agreed that the targets are soft and they need some stretch. The CEO has indicated that they have amended some of their targets. There is an ongoing discussion around how to strengthen and beef that, but I think we must also balance capacity constraints and financial constraints as we're looking at performance and trying to identify stretch targets. So I think we are engaged in those discussions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Group Chief Operating Officer, thank you. So over to yourself then, Ms. Motsagai.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the members for those questions. In terms of riders lending, Honourable Chair, this is we've seen this, you know, across all types of entities, whether it be micro lenders, the retailers, you know, and the banks, and we've referred some of these cases already to the National Consumer Tribunal. So we do take reckless lending as NCR, you know, quite seriously. In terms of reputation for each loan that is extended, in terms of the availability assessment regulations that came into force in September 2015, it is a requirement of every credit provider to make sure that they verify the income that is reported to them by consumers whenever they apply for credit. So that is mandatory. You know, that has to be verified. You also referred, Honourable Chair, to the slide which talks to not applicable. The audits, credit bureau audits are done once a year, and therefore this is in terms of the information that is reported by the auditors in the audit report. In respect of any contraventions by credit bureaus, seven of those entities, eight of those entities, we did not. There were no non-compliance issues that were reported, and hence, you know, the six that were referred for further investigation, and the number of enforcement actions that were taken, you know, against those. So that's the reason why we are, you know, reporting about six and not the balance. We do accept what Honourable Williams and Honourable Albers are saying, and this is something that we will definitely take up. I will need to check and maybe perhaps the Deputy CEO can help, but I think this we have incorporated in the bill that also talks to NCR being given power to impose fines. I think we included it in the back, yes, that is, we do note it. It will definitely submit such a proposal if it is not incorporated in the current bill. Thank you.
Right. Now, members, I just want to address just a couple of points to the NCR, National Credit Regulator, our CEO. When we rose for constituency to undertake elections, etc., the issue of debt forgiveness was here, decision was taken, resolution was passed for us to pursue this, and there was an agreement also from the DTI that, yes, they certainly saw the need for this, and yourself. With respect to powers regarding the current enforcement of current regulations, we decided we should not be conflated with debt forgiveness. So there's a need for us to separate the two issues. We do want to be taking this up again and pick up from where we left off. And I'm just looking at the schedules that we have. I'm not going to go into the detail of it. It does look as if we really have some very heavy work ahead of us. There is a Friday available, and I do regard this as a very important issue. So we will address it and come back to you to see if we can't have a specific engagement on this matter. I'm also looking at the NRCS on the 14th of September, and there's a lot of space there.
and so we may be looking at that date. We will come back to you on the matter. Right. I'd like to thank you. Yes?
Can I just ask? I mean, the LCS is quite a contentious issue, and I would ask if we can deal with that separately, because we're going to be, you know, hopefully having the risk-based management tool before us, so we can actually interrogate that without the sort of need to hurry up to accommodate another entity.
It is the Wednesday. The house only at 3 o'clock. Therefore, from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, I would have thought 6 hours was enough for two engagements, not one. I also aim to be efficient. Now, what I was saying is thank you very much for addressing and engaging us on this issue, but it is a serious matter, and a lot of the current debt, I'm not sure that it's even valid. And we do need to look into the matter and investigate it. It does strike me as odd that when a financial institution makes a mistake in your name and so on and so forth, well, they don't expect you to take any further action. Sorry, we made a mistake. You know? And you've had to actually take out a lot of action, use your time and your own resources to prove you're not this person. And what happens? Sorry. And we must I don't accept that any longer. And I think that those of us sitting here are far better equipped than the average South African to address this matter and these matters. I also, as I recognized earlier, we've got some, I was about to say the dam busters, but what are they, the debt busters? There was a very famous film based on facts on the Second World War called The Dam Busters. Now, the debt busters, we've got a Mr. Is it Watson or Wasson? How do you spell it?
Watson.
It reminds me of an advert and Mr. Warner and whatever. Sorry about
that. Apologies, that's my first time. It's Wason, W-A-S-O-N.
Great, Wason. And that's from Debt Busters, and we also have a colleague of yours by the looks of things, Mr. James O'Hawley. Is that right, Irish name?
You can say O'Hawley, but well done.
That's probably the Irish pronunciation. Thank you. Then we also have legal advisor to the Old Mutual. Where are you? Hiding there, right. That's Aline Smith. And then we have the legal compliance specialist of the Fushini Group. Right at the back, yes. And that's Jean Roberta. Is that right? And then we have Lorata Molloy, the manager regulatory advocacy, Standard Bank Group. Where are you? Well, frankly, I can't see you because the, you know, that railing is hiding your face. Fine. That's great. So it's good to hear that some members of the private sector are taking this very seriously. I hope none of you sitting here today are fraudulent or, you know, masquerading as debt counsellors. There's no unregistered debt counsellor here. Is that right? No unregistered debt counsellors. Good. Right. We've got the National Credit Regulator right here to give you instruction. Now, on that note, thank you very much for coming. Thank you to the DG, Lionel October, and the Group Chief Operating Officer, Ms. Josie Scott, and of course our Deputy CEO, Mr. Tongwane. Now, I want to address a few things in committee, the announcement. We've received a letter from the... Here's this from? From Ms. Jo Blanche, who is from the tribunal, and this is the National Consumer Tribunal. We asked if we could attend one of these motion courts. Do you remember that? And they said, yes, we'll send you an invitation to whenever we're down in your part of the world, which they have now done,
and they indicate that there are two possibilities. It is the 7th of September, which unfortunately is not feasible for this committee. You can see why, because on that date we've got CRT, CSABs and the like. The alternative is the 3rd to the 7th of October. We have yet to draw up that program, and the reason we haven't is because it is in constituency. We return to Parliament on the 11th, Tuesday the 11th. So I will certainly make copies of the invitation to committee members, because you would need to engage your respective senior whips as to whether you will be able to attend or not. So I will make this available to you as an invitation. I hope that some of us will be able to attend 1 or 2 days. Is everyone happy with that? Fine. Thank you. The last... Yes, but I thought in between babysitting duties. So, you know, no. Obviously, you have your plans, and I didn't want to assume that you would be free. But thank you very much. If you can, that would be a great idea. We will certainly discuss it, see how many, I'm sure, in the ANC would be able to attend. Then there's the Freedom Front. I don't know if there's anyone in your party that could attend, you know. Down here in Cape Town, there's the IMP who's here regularly. We'll check with them as well. We'd also like, Ms. Naidoo, to send a member of staff along, and we'll discuss that at length. That's that particular one. Is there anything else in terms of announcements? Right. Quite a few items are pending. We'll come back on Tuesday in that regard. I do want to thank members who sat here throughout the meeting. Thank you very much. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.